Well, good evening and a very warm welcome, one and all, to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. A little bit of a problem with the mic there, but everything looks to be working all right. That was Georgia Satellites, Keep Your Hands to Yourself, and before that, Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble playing Love Struck Baby, and then Brian Ferry, of course, and The Price of Love. Well, it's been a fairly eventful few weeks down at the surgery, really. It's a good time of year for people who like to be out there wielding the shovel. And we've got one very interesting experiment running. We're used to growing all of our vegetables and things on in pots in various greenhouses or polytunnels or whatever, and then planting them out in the garden. And this year we decided to try a new method and just bung more or less everything in the ground in the first week in June when everything kind of warmed up, and see how it went. And it really has been very remarkable. Hopefully we'll get some photos together on Dropbox or something and have a look at that in the next couple of shows or so, because it's amazing how it's working. Got some really, really healthy plants. Also, in the last week or so, me and Synchro finally got to go and do some woofing, some willing work on an organic farm a little further, kind of west of us in Mid Wales. Something we've been aiming on doing for some time, and had a really astonishing time there. Actually got to herd some sheep and make cheese, and there's the opportunities for milking cows and doing lots of horticulture, and people from all over the world. Absolutely fascinating 10 days or so was spent up there, and I think we'll be going back to have some more of that, I should imagine, in July. But that's all for future shows, I think. Got some lovely photos of all of that stuff, and there really are some amazing things being done out in the Welsh countryside by determined and cooperative people working together. I find it, as you can tell, most thrilling. But for this week's show, I want to go back a little bit in time, back to mid-May, when I'd finished doing the volunteer coordinating down at the Tribal Love Cooperative's gig out at Thorston Park, and was back closer to Glastonbury and helping to set up for the Music and Medicine Festival, which was a bit of a new experience for me. The crewing wasn't new. I was looking forward to that. It's just the usual stuff, turning up and helping out, doing what needs to be done. I wasn't sure what I was going to make of the festival itself. I knew that there was going to be a fair bit of chanting and omming, some of which I've come across and I really enjoy, and I figured there was probably going to be a lot of other interesting stuff too, and indeed there was. And I managed to get a couple of chats with some interesting people. As many of you will know, I tend to gather my interviews as I wander from place to place and discover people who seem to be working their way to their own kind of solutions, and it's a couple of them we're going to be listening to tonight. The first is a chat with Tim Wheater, who's actually quite famous, as it turns out. He's a very charismatic guy, really nice and informed individual to spend time with, very, very fascinating to listen to. And also, clearly, a very talented musician who can play lots of different sorts of instruments from across time, really. And so this is a bit of a chat that the doctor had with him before he went and did a bit of a performance at the actual music festival, which was in Glastonbury Football Club, if I remember rightly. So here we go. Here's the first of tonight's talky bits. It's Dr. Rock talking to Tim Wheater about the power sound can have to help us heal. Thank you.
nicely. So I'm very, very lucky to have Tim Wheater with me. It's a real pleasure to meet you. I'm looking forward to seeing your performance this afternoon at the Music and Medicine Festival. And you're interested specifically in the use of sound for healing, is that right?
I am. I'm increasingly aware how sound can be a very powerful medium for transformation of obviously an individual person or indeed society. And that's nothing new, I have to add, but I think we're living in an extraordinary time, a day and age when these things are becoming more important. There's a greater awareness springing up around them. So my work specifically is both recordings, which are used all over the world. They're used in spas and clinics and indeed hospitals, and then individual healing sessions as well. And that's a result of creating some music that's relatively ambient in its feel and character, quite mellow, and has the ability to calm people. I also work very sort of proactively live, both concert-wise, but also working with audiences to introduce them to sound, and specifically, if I can say that, frequencies. So going marginally technical for a minute, it isn't just about making music for me that's in a, let's say, a standard tuning, as we understand it, but I'm using pitch and sounds that are slightly different, but they're a bit more in sympathy both with the earth, with the planets, and indeed with our bodies. And just to give you the technical analysis of that, it's very simple. It's like taking the note A, if you have a piano at home, let's say, hypothetically, and someone comes to tune the piano. They're generally going to tune it as a standard pitch, which I have to tell you was introduced in 1939 by Hitler's deputy, at 440. I work more in Pythagorean pitch. He's the ancient Greek mathematician, philosopher, who actually evolved the mathematics of sound and the planetary system emitting sounds as well, which is known as the harmony of the spheres. I work with that, so the note becomes A432. This is a slightly more harmonious note within the body. It obviously then affects the mind as well, and can bring about a tremendous feeling of calm.
And so the whole scale moves a given number, because these are hertz you're talking about.
They are. Now, yeah. Hertz is the number of vibrations per second. So when I say 432, it's 432 hertz. That's the number of vibrations per second. So it's a very slight difference. It's kind of a tad lower. But as I say, it's more sympathetic to the body and can affect a greater healing process. And if I may just explain very quickly how sound works. Obviously, it's, you know, we're imbibing it through the ears, which are the very first sense, as I am led to believe in many of us, that we're aware of, even from day 45 within our mother's womb, we're listening.
You can hear, can't you, what's going on in the outside world.
So we're listening, and indeed they often suggest that listening and the hearing is the last sense almost that we're conscious of as we perhaps pass on. So I'm using, as I say, sounds and working with people to create a harmonious link. But as I was saying, specifically how it works in the body, there's a scientific process of analysing sound called cymatics. And cymatics is where, let's say, theoretically, you have a copper plate, some sand on the top, and you play sound at this. It will produce the most magical, beautiful patterns, almost mandala-like shapes, prismatic shapes. And the hypothesis is that, as you're listening, is in turn affecting the individual, the water content of the body. Our 70% of water is being shaped and contoured to this sound. So you're creating a very positive, good vibration within the body. Obviously, sound has, it affects the mind as well, and the idea is that it's going to bring, hopefully, a harmonious mode of thinking to the mind, bring people into a sort of more balanced spectrum of thinking about life and accepting life and being part of life. But also, to conclude this little sort of statement about it, I think what is interesting about, as I'm discovering, being very scientific and precise about the pictures, one, it gives you a certain scientific and medical credibility, because it is established that these sounds do correlate to the human body.
Well, so orthodoxy is prepared to accept this, is it?
I think more and more so, and I often coin an interesting expression called, I believe sound is very rapidly becoming the ancient medicine of the future.
Nice.
So it's about introducing these sounds, and they allow the listener to bring him or herself more into harmony, obviously both with himself, but with nature as well. Mm-hmm. You integrate better into the natural creativity of the world mm-hmm. around us, the miracle of life.
Yeah. So just to return to the cymatics a moment. So
yes.
Do you see with your new slightly lower pitch, do you see a whole different progression of patterns?
Yes, there will be a different, completely different spectrum introduced, actually.
Because the new one does, the scale we're currently using, does produce really coherent patterns, doesn't it?
It does. By its nature, you know, a note is obviously going to create a shape, but you can enhance this just by, let's say, adjusting the tuning marginally. And I think this is the way that we're all going. There's a big movement now amongst musicians to maybe adopt that pitch. And just to add one other thing, there's another set of pitches I also work with called the solfeggio, which is actually a slightly higher spectrum of tuning. And that works within the system of codes of the number three, any derivatives of the number three. So, for example, the core fundamental tone of that is 111 hertz, 111, adding up to a 3. Now, 111 hertz in the solfeggio is a tuning in a frequency which assists and helps the release of endorphins in the brain. Used a lot within medical fraternity, within drug addiction, actually. Mm-hmm. It can be a substitute for methadone, etc.
So, again, we've heard before on the show about how sound can be, a given frequency can be played to water, and it's like adding whatever the chemical or physical yes. product is that has that frequency, because everything has a unique frequency,
absolutely.
Doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that includes us, so because we're all made up of vibratory structures as well.
Mm.
It's interesting, isn't it, that we seem to have chosen a pitch that's somewhere between a lower one, which works really well in one way, and a higher one, which works really well in the other. Anyone would think they were trying to undermine us, eh?
Well, that's a very, very good point. And actually, to sort of put the fly in the ointment, the pitch that has been imposed, and I use the word quite carefully there, upon the world and the way music is made, was actually, as I understand, part of a research project by the US Navy Department of the Rockefeller Foundation to understand how certain sound could control the masses to a degree.
And that's where Goebbels got it from.
Goebbels had obviously studied the research. Whether they're in cahoots, I have no idea. Who knows? There's always that possibility, as we
certainly
understand
is.
History. But certainly in 1939, against much opposition, he did impose this legally. And then, of course, we have the war following
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting.
And then it became accepted for
yeah.
orchestral tuning and
yeah.
presumably for the tuning of all the, you know, pop bands and
yes, in
as
the
far
main,
as they are tuned.
In the main, but there are some deviances from that. For example, John Lennon's Imagine is in my 4/32 tuning.
Now, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Because they say that Imagine is a song that will last because it's the first song to get, generally the first song to get moved onto any new technology.
Yes.
So it's not just the words.
Yes.
It's being backed up by
yes.
the sound.
Yes. So subtle as it is, these things do underpin and give a kind of importance to the sound and the way it can affect you. It can basically amplify the effect
yeah.
of the sound within your body.
Are there any other songs that people would be familiar with that have used that?
Offhand, as you ask me now, I don't think I can quote you in things, but I'm sure there are other examples for sure. It's becoming quite hip, so I think there's quite a lot of contemporary music being made. Generally, I have to add in solfeggio, actually, because that's kind of very a la mode at the moment. Because what that contains, the solfeggio, is a frequency of 528 vibrations per second, so 528, which is known, and certainly in the solfeggio scale, which is, if anyone has ever seen the Sound of Music, get the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, si, do thing happening. Well, the 528 is the mi within that scale, and the mi is obviously to a degree euphemistically an abbreviation of miracle, so it's the miracle frequency. It is suggested that that is the frequency that scientists can repair human DNA in a laboratory with. That in its own way would be an implication that we are all 7 billion of us on this planet, tuned to that frequency. And just to give you one extra little scientific bit of data around this, it's my understanding as you increase the velocity of sound, as you speed it up, it has the capability of creating light. And this is something the ancients knew within the wonderful spaces they created. For example, like Newgrange,
yes,
and certainly the pyramids and some of the sacred architecture of the cathedrals and the mosques. It was suggested that there are certain chords can really help elicit a presence of light in that situation. But the implication, of course, is then that we are all... So let's just say sound speeds up, it becomes light. The scientific process is called sonoluminescence. This would mean that we are all beings of sound and light. This is our natural way, our frequency, our vibration. And it's quite a revelation to consider that, because it to a degree, can change your life philosophy to a degree, I think.
Yes, indeed. And I've realised fairly recently that there is a relationship between... Well, I mean, we have 8 basic colours, the 7 basic colours of the rainbow, plus the 8th one that you see at the end. So I've always thought there's a relationship between our musical scale and the scales of colour. It also means, of course, that that's our kind of chord, isn't it? So we're introducing a discord on a completely different level.
I think also the fact that you know, I'm working in this way and questioning traditional ways that have, let's say, been around for the last 60, 70 years, and I'm certainly not alone, I might add. There are many other musicians, my peer group, thinking the same way. I think it would really indicate that there is a movement galvanizing itself of enlightenment around the way sound affects us, and an understanding how we can be of assistance to changing people's consciousness on a very broad level.
Well, we know, don't we, that music in its finest forms can be just so uplifting. I mean, I always think of Mozart when I'm thinking of that, because I find even a bit pieces that I don't know well can be really enlivening to listen to.
Absolutely. Mozart's an interesting example, because there's a very famous book called The Mozart Effect, where he talks about the way Mozart has this ability to sort of have a very slow pattern of sound, and it speeds up, and it's very much creating a bridge between both sides of the brain. So sound and music, I believe, really accompanies us from the cradle to the grave. Within the use of my music, as I understand from feedback I receive, there are a lot of, indeed, even going before the birth, there are people that are babies that are conceived to the music, they're babies born to the music. It's used a lot within holistic patterns of care and work. It's used within hospice work. And oddly enough, of late, I've had a lot of emails and letters about how many people are passing over to also listening to my music and similar music.
Brilliant. So people are being born and dying to it.
Yeah, and I think what sound can do, if it's, let's say, created with the right intention, it can act as a tremendous solace to us all. You know, so it can enliven, for sure, and we can get the foot tapping and we want to dance and move, and that's a very beautiful aspect of it. But there are other times when sound can act as a very gentle cradle, just holding us in those times of need and requirement of some other emotional impact within us. So it's a very beautiful thing, and I think it's sort of it's quite important to understand that it's quite rightly conceived to be entertaining, because sound is something which, as I say, accompanies us all the way through our life. It's like a soundtrack individual to each of our lives. Beyond entertainment, music and sound can also, as I say, be this functional art of healing and of transformation. And I think that's what we're also facing at the moment. So, yeah, we can obviously have our release and move, and, you know, and that's incredibly welcome. But we can also use it with this understanding that we're bringing, as I say, healing and solace and comfort to ourselves individually. That obviously then patterns out into society at large. And certainly if people like myself, and as I say, many other artists working in this, with the same mindset, we're creating music, then you're subtly introducing sounds, as I say, that are so much more sympathetic, and people even don't kind of know what they're receiving, rather like the sound that we're hearing at the moment. But hopefully you're giving them a slightly more positive vibration and frequency.
It is a very tiny change, isn't it?
Tiny change, very, very, very subtle, but it's... dare I say, I'm not a great mathematician, but it is part of it. Just adds and completes part of the mathematics that create us and make us tick, let's say. It's all part of these codes, these sacred codes that create nature, etc.
As a matter of interest, can you hear the difference between music that's played in one and the other?
Obviously, we're very conditioned to hear 440, so I'm, you know, and we're, you know, we hear this so much of the time, but I am conscious more when I hear the 432. It's a little bit more, there's a little bit more light coming in through the window, if I may use that as a sort of little analogy. So if anything, I'm more conscious of the tunings I'm now using. I'm a bit more oblivious to this other one, but I can hear the calm that the work that is that we're all working on is bringing. So it is subtle, but there is a certain obvious nature to it. Yes.
I think that's fantastic, because it could make just for such a huge change, and it's very, very subliminal, as indeed was the change in the other direction.
Yeah.
Although people, as you say, were resisting it, and it was done really against people's will.
Yeah.
It is so, and you're going to make a huge subliminal difference. The more music people hear that's written like that, well, just think about Imagine, which must be a song that's made a huge difference to the world in different ways. One of the performers yesterday, Jason Stillwell, I'll go and make the tea in a minute. Jason Stillwell came up with the phrase. He said, what we say is that intent plus sound equals manifestation. And I notice you connected intent and sound there. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do, actually. That's a lovely quote. I have a slightly different quote, but it's obviously very much in sympathy to that. Intention and frequency are a kind of recipe which equal holistic resonance. And when you have this meaning, holistic resonance is then where it is literally affecting the mind, the body, the spirit, bringing the body into harmony and balance, etc. So, yeah. Intention, very, very important part of it. And, of course, that's part of our what we're seeing now as a movement of mindfulness and everything. You know, there's so many wonderful changes occurring, aren't there, at grassroots. Yeah.
We did actually do an experiment in that yesterday afternoon. He got us all to make the heart sound, the ah.
Yes.
And the group of people we've got there naturally tune themselves. It's a beautiful sound. We did three of those, and then he said, right, now I want you to put love. I want you to put love and intensity of love into that, and the intention of spreading it right around the world, and then I want you to make the R sound again. And you genuinely could feel the difference in quality between the two sounds.
I think that's great. It sounds a bit like the things I say, actually. I wish I'd been there to
he's
hear
going
that,
to be on, he's going to be on again today.
Well,
so
fabulous, because that's very... I'm absolutely on the same page. Yeah, beautiful, and a beautiful effect when you hear this done with people, yeah. And to introduce people to it... who aren't necessarily initiated or aware of this at the moment, it's a great experience for them.
It was thrilling. Yeah. It was. And I mean, the basic effect on me seemed to be that when I got back yesterday, I fell asleep for 4 hours, and I was properly asleep, you know.
Yeah.
I'll just go and knock up a cup of tea. Right. The next question I'd like to ask is if I'm thinking about the Aborigines, who play a lot of music, don't they? And they sometimes make their instruments out of natural things. I want to know how their scales relate to ours, but I'll be back in 2 minutes.
Yeah, so you're talking about indigenous pitch.
Yes, I'm thinking about it, because obviously they, I mean, I know that there've been humans in Australia for 40,000 years or something, so presumably their music is a bit of an indication of where they've come from.
In the main, and obviously there will be, you know, variations, but in the main, they quite naturally and spontaneously work in this pitch I was talking about, this 432. The pitch is marginally lower. And it is as though, I would imagine, you know, their understanding of the earth and the patterns of the rhythm of the earth and just their sense to nature has brought that about quite naturally. I had a dilemma only a couple of weeks ago. I had to play a solo with the Royal Philharmonic, but on a native American flute I've got, And, it was a nightmare because it was just that little bit lower to the pitch they were playing. So I had to sort of find something that would sort of slightly come up in pitch. So, yeah, often if we use these more natural indigenous instruments, they have quite naturally pitched that little bit lower, which is in sympathy to the body.
It makes them a lot more difficult to play with a whole orchestra.
Yeah. It was a challenge. Yeah.
What do the orchestras think of this?
There's a lot of musicians, I think, certainly within the classical idiom, who maybe are not quite as aware yet. Although, you know, academically, I think there are, you know, many trains of thought around this. There are a lot of musicians very pro this slightly lower pitch than we have at the present time. So, because when Goebbels imposed this as law, there was a tremendous amount of opposition because musicians did want to be using this slightly lower pitch. Mm. It's easier, actually, oddly enough, on the voice. So even if you could take yourself into the classical idiom, opera singers, just this slight lowering just assists the vocal cords. There's more resonance. Now, the opposite is also true, oddly enough, when we talk about the solfeggio, which is slightly higher. There's a few really top orchestras like the Berlin Philharmonic, Chicago, etc., who actually do tune more into that solfeggio range. My understanding is they do it not for the reason that they're suddenly into some series of codes, but it actually makes, cosmetically, it makes the strings sound a bit brighter, so there's just a sort of little bit more excitement there.
Yeah.
So there is an awareness. So this 4/4, much as, you know, it is the kind of standard thing, there are variances out there.
And presumably the solfeggio makes it a bit harder for the singers to keep track, does it?
Or very much, and hard on string players as well, because I've tried this. I use a few stringed instruments. So it's what really got me back into the 4/4, because I spent about a year really delving into the solfeggio, and I loved it, and I do have a whole series of instruments that are tuned that way, and I work in that field quite a lot, particularly in London. It's very popular. But I found at one point I just experimented going back into this other, more ancient pitch, and everything was a bit easier. It all stayed in tune more, and I sort of thought, and then it felt more calm to me. I thought, oh, this is interesting. Okay, so that's why I tend to work with both.
Yeah.
I'm slightly veering more into the ancient Pythagorean at the moment, I'm finding, but it's just a thought.
After our conversation last night, it occurred to me that the geometry talks I do, which I describe as being an exploration of how number unfolds into space, it is an exploration, because, of course, music is another way that number unfolds into space.
Absolutely.
Which is a bit of a revelation to me, really.
Absolutely. I mean, my very crude understanding is that everything is made up of vibration and thus maths and codes, and this is obviously a belief they had, the ancients had. There's an expression in Sanskrit, comes from India, which is Nada Brahma, and Nada Brahma translates as the world is sound. It's this understanding everything is vibrating. When we're actually producing music, as musicians or singers, whatever, you know, you have to consider what's happening. You're creating a sound, and then there's a transmission of this sound, as in energy traveling. So, you know, that ties in with this aspect of the intention. You know, how is that transmitting? How are you delivering it? Communicating it? It all becomes communication in a way. Mm. Matching, as I said, ideally into the codes of the body. And it just brings about a wholeness. It's a more holistic, organic way of looking at sound, I believe, actually.
Yeah. The phrase you just had from the Indians reminded me of the beginning of the Bible. In the beginning was the Word.
And the Word was on, as I often call
it. Right, yeah, indeed. Or as Terry Pratchett puts it, in the beginning was the chord.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, potentially that is where everything has come forth from. You know, literally, as they say, the Big Bang and the boom, and then we have creation. All coming about through sound and light, which are obviously, as I said before, interrelated.
They're all waves, aren't they? It's a matter of amplitude and frequency.
Yes.
So have you seen any of the babies? Do you know any of the babies that are born listening to?
I do.
And how are they faring?
Awesome. And in fact, it's so funny because there was a girl who was born to my music and who's played my music in the womb for 6 months before her birth. she wrote to me about a month ago, and she was within a week or so about to give birth to her baby, who likewise had been played my music. She'd tried other music, but the baby was, again, more receptive to mine, and it's as though coming through the bloodline, because the mother had had this introduction to the sounds and yeah. absorption of it, it's as though it had passed on to the baby.
Well, that's not entirely unlikely, is it? Because I know that research that was done after the after what happened with the amazing disappearance of buildings in New York, they examined a lot of women who were in the third trimester of their pregnancy, whose cortisol levels obviously were raised hugely by the stress of the event. They gave birth to babies whose cortisol levels were raised as well.
Absolutely.
And what we're talking about here is doing the other thing. Also, the intent flows in there as well, because a lot of people seem to think that their baby's not actually alive until it's born, and so perhaps are a bit careless about what they play to it, and, you know, kind of what sounds it is the baby gets to hear. So it's not just that they're playing something that's more comfortable and possibly better attuned to the child itself, but they've also got the intent of doing that,
yes.
which will be making a difference to the child too.
Indeed, and there's an expression we use in sound therapy, sound healing, called entrainment, which is where you, by introducing a particular sound or rhythm, you really can influence the rhythm of the heart and the pulse of the body, the way the blood's flowing in the other individual. So I'm sure that's part of the pattern that's going on with these babies in the womb and then being born, etc.
That's absolutely marvellous, isn't it, really? Because that is a very, very hard and practical use for music generally, but B for, you know, the lower pitch that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And then at the other end of life, I mean, it's been my feeling for some time that one of the reasons we're here is to learn how to leave graciously and properly and not in a state of panic, and that there is a disadvantage in not leaving consciously. And so you can arrive consciously by having this music played to you, and then presumably if you get the joy of arriving that way and then leaving that way, it would work even better. How else do you think that we can how else do you think people can readily use sound to improve their everyday lives?
Well, I'm a great believer. I work with large groups of people that maybe they're uninitiated in using sound, or it's been denied to them, so using their own voices. You know, it's a healing instrument we're born with. Great believer in people just humming and oohing and ahhing and what I call toning, which is where you just, you know, little shape of in the mouth like an ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very smooth, gentle sound. It's quite potent. So this, that, conscious listening, I think other life habits, you know, assist, you know, drink lots of water and
yeah.
all those sort of things, be aware of what you're eating. I'm a great believer these days, you know, I think people should kind of shop in the health food store for their toothpaste and whatever
yeah.
bathroom requisites they require. Not commercial. I think it's about us ideally turning our backs on the big machine, making all these commercial products with all the chemicals.
Mm.
I think they assist our vibration as well. So I think a lot of these things come hand in hand.
Yeah. Yeah, we now... I do a regular Shakespeare play every year because we've got a Living Willow Theatre back in Mid Wales. And we use a lot of sound for warming our voices up. Not only to improve your projection, but we use that mmm and ah to actually get vibrations going in our head.
Fabulous.
Which actually improves our performance as well.
Fabulous.
Because it somehow seems to enliven the brain ready for the stage experience, because it does need to be operating on a slightly different level.
Yes.
What about in nature? Just if we're thinking about things like the humming of bees and because that I found a deeply relaxing sound, and I know many people do.
I think it's great, and I'm so glad you mentioned the bees. Bees are obviously, first of all, paramount, very important that we protect the bees, as they often say, if the bees go, we've got about 4 years left of life, so that's a little
all of which
statistic.
Will be spent rushing around trees with little paintbrushes.
My understanding is that bees are naturally in this pitch I'm talking about, this more Pythagorean lower pitch. And if we introduce, let's say we took a tuning fork, you know, it's that little metal thing, literally like a fork that vibrates, that people use to sort of tune instruments up, and indeed nowadays we use them within therapy. If you took a, a tuning fork that was tuned in our standard concert pitch as we have it now, next to a beehive, they wouldn't be able to fly. They fly, their wings are buzzing at the specific frequency I'm talking about, and they would be unable to fly if we introduced the different frequencies. So they are totally in tune.
That is amazing, isn't it? Because that's another physical demonstration, if one's needed, of the effect of resonance. And although I would assume that although we're not flying and we're not disabled, can't be disabled from flying by a tuning fork, quite a lot of our abilities might well be being slightly honed down in a similar way, but less noticeable to us.
Yes, this is it. It's subtle. My belief is that the pitch that we hear is it's more to an extent of inflaming the lower chakras as opposed to assisting the more harmonious upper chakras of life, yeah. You know, and this would probably explain why there is this sort of alpha male macho element of war and descent, etc.
Yeah, and you get to see it again and again in the films as well. A lot of things are designed to keep us in these lower three chakras at the time when we're supposed to be ascending to the heart.
Yes.
Somebody pointed out to me the other day that it's funny, isn't it, that you never get to see anybody in a film or a movie or a TV program who's successfully using a gun to keep the peace or to prevent violence, and yet apparently the presence of guns in America has been pretty well demonstrated, that the actual presence of guns in the homes of homeowners, not because they're going to use them, but because they could, is actually responsible for keeping crime levels down. But you never see it in the films. So I see another link here with trying to keep our vibration low. But it's one that we're breaking away from, which is marvellous, of course, at this time. So what are you working on at the moment?
Well, I'm very keen to sort of really embrace a more popular side of music, to sort of reach out to a larger demographic of people. So what I'm meaning by that is that, you know, I'm working more with beats and rhythm and such things, people more in the pop arena of working. There's a lot of enthusiasm from particularly the younger generation, very receptive to these things. So my dream is, to create something that's got a bit of a commercial kick to it, but that reaches a lot of people, but has this subtle subliminal influence almost. Mm.
That must be very exciting for you.
Yeah, I think we're at an amazing time in a way. This is different but akin to the changes I believe that the 60s brought about. I mean, that was a different movement, but I'm of the mind that we're all part of. We've really got to invent a new evolution, a new paradigm of thinking and of being. So, you know, perhaps we can call an expression, we're part of a re-evolution.
Re-evolution.
So it's a kind of revolution of the senses and the masses and the heart, but a re-evolution is an easier way to go about it, perhaps.
Because I heard for the first time last night your album Heartland. I didn't hear all of it. I heard probably the first half, and it really reminded me of overtone singing and chanting that I heard from Vesely. And it reminded me of Gregorian chants and all that kind of stuff that I did. Although, known as Dr. Rock, I do tend to play a lot of rock music and bluegrass and stuff, but I found that stuff very moving. Doesn't mean to say it'll necessarily get played on the show, although I will play some after this interview. But I found it did have a very, especially on the first listening, I can imagine that once you get a bit more familiar with it, it'll be even more fun to listen to.
Yeah, I think it helps people journey and access to quite an interesting space, you know, slightly removed from all the challenges and fragilities of life, let's say. Sometimes it's good to escape to another realm. I think to a degree, you know, it's very almost thin ice to start to talk about divine and sacred and everything. But, you know, I think we all have a yearning to sort of touch the magic and the mystery that surrounds us. Perhaps in this day and age, to a degree surpassing traditional faith and religion. So I think music like that can assist people touch something quite special. within themselves, and as I say, within the greater magic and the mystery that surrounds us.
And if you're doing things like meditation and manifestation, it is another one of those things which at the periphery is going to, it's going to up your performance level a little bit.
I think all of these things are great gifts for us, yeah. I think it's great so many more and more of us are embracing this different mode of thinking, but that is actually quite ancient and traditional.
Yes.
Probably how our ancestors were.
Yeah, new and ancient. We had to lose it in order to regain it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm,
brilliant.
So a lot of work to be done, but really exciting times. I think we all just need to, first of all, take stock of who we are, where we are, do our own... ideally, not self-evaluation or so, but, you know, our healing of whatever might be imposing itself on our lives. Sort of clean our own act up a bit. And, you know, I think if we can do that individually, and then obviously we're meeting each other, and there's a kind of community building, which I am witnessing, and that's global. I think very, very important, fertile, amazing times. I think we're on the threshold of great things, actually.
In so many different ways as well. It seems that we're all rising up together.
Mm.
Mm. I think that's really interesting. And I've been waiting for a long time, actually, to talk to somebody about the Solvaggio and the new pitches, because I've not found anybody firsthand who's actually doing it to talk to me about it, although I do know concert musicians and the like. And I know you're due on the stage pretty shortly over at the festival, so...
Yeah.
We probably need to call it quits and head off there. So in closing, have you got a website that people can go and look at?
TimWheater.com, TimWheater.com, TimWheater.com. Yeah, there's a little bit of info on that. I'm, you know, often around at festivals and spreading the word, sort of starting to, you know, it's taking it globally. I'm going to China in a month or so, and... So it's getting out there, hopefully.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very, very much for
my pleasure.
For sharing some of your time with us, and I look forward to hearing more of what you're doing, and I shall certainly be investigating the website. As I say, I couldn't do it before the chat, because we have no internet here, which is as much a blessing as it is a curse, I think.
Of course.
So,
thank you.
So we'll get our pods on and head off back to the Glastonbury Football Club, then.
Absolutely.
The Temple of Testosterone for a bit of serious work.
Absolutely. That's great.
Thank you very so much. Thanks, Tim.
You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com, Seeking Solutions Together. That was Dexter Dextrous and his Fingersmiths, and the title track from their All Talk EP. And before that, there was a slight gap courtesy of a bit of local electricity collapse, which is a novelty, but I think that everything's back and stable now. And before the interruption was Alabama 3, Too Sick to Pray. Before that, I was talking to the extremely interesting Tim Wheater. He's a man with a lot to say, and well worth visiting timwheater.com, his website, to see all the various things that he's been up to. The two bits of flute playing, Andean flute playing, that came before and after the interview were also Tim. I recorded that on the Wee Voice Recorder at the Music Medicine Festival. And pretty amazing, really. I've been aware for some time that the scale that everybody's using, as far as I can tell, in the Western world, certainly Western-tuned bands and orchestras and all of that. It's not quite what it was, say, in the times of the Greeks. Excuse me. Got a bit of a husky voice tonight. And I didn't know why that had happened, and as I said to Tim, I'd been waiting for an opportunity to talk to somebody about it. And it turned out that Goebbels had been reading up on some research that the American Navy had done, and they'd come up with this frequency, or a way, if you like, of pinning all of our scales so that they are more suitable for, in Tim's words, in some sense, for the control of the masses. He also reminded us of something that we've heard of many times before on the show, that that water is affected by resonance. It's affected to the point where you can actually play a sound file of the resonance of a chemical of some sort to a flask of water, and it has the same effect as dropping the chemical into the water. And it's not, of course, just water in beakers. We're 70% water, our brains are 80% water, so these resonances that we hear around us are physically affecting the way in which our corporeal body, as it were, actually functions. And so we can see that this sort of very subtle manipulation could be making a difference on all sorts of levels. All the movie theme tunes we hear and all the songs that are in them, all the sound effects that go with the advertisements on the criminal mainstream media, all of that stuff is working on us differently than it would do if it was just 8 hertz or so higher. And isn't it, I mean, I suppose one shouldn't be amazed anymore, but one still is amazed by the fact that we can have somebody like Goebbels going, well, that's the way you're going to do it, guys, in 1939. And despite the fact that the musicians really didn't want to go that way, lo, it became so nonetheless. Tim also pointed out that the older frequencies, the two that he mentioned are the Solvaggio, which is a pegging, if you like, of the scale at a higher frequency than the one that we're currently using, and the 432, the Pythagorean or Platonic tuning, which is about 8 hertz lower. So both of those are more in tune with the human energetic structure than the one that we're currently using, and it does things like those frequencies help the release of endorphins, which are part of the hormonal system that help to determine how it is that we perceive the what's loosely called the consensus. It's not really a consensus at all, but endorphins are one of the critical parts of assuring whether we feel good or bad about the things that are happening to us. And as you heard Tim say, the children that have had this stuff played to them in the womb seem to be born pretty relaxed, and now he's getting to witness the second generation being born using these techniques. And I'm always impressed by stuff that gets successfully used in hospices, because as he said, we can be using music for dancing and singing and jumping up and down, or we can use it as a kind of support, if you like, as a kind of resonant cradle in which to lie. He said indeed in some experiments it's been shown that sound at the correct frequencies and with the correct kind of ambience can be used as a substitute for methadone. That's a pretty powerful effect, isn't it? You'd have thought that people might be looking a little bit deeper into that one. Another thing he said, which I thought was pretty interesting, was that the 528 hertz resonance can be used to repair human DNA. I'm currently involved in another wee interchange with the dental side of the NHS, which is proving to be quite interesting. I'm sure that there'll be one or two fascinating discussions had as a result of that. But one of the things that my dentist didn't tell me is that bone can be replaced by separating the blood. They separate the red from the white blood streams, and then it's possible to spin at a given frequency, whichever one, I think it's the white blood that's actually got the DNA in it. And according to given frequencies, it will become different things. It could become bone or ligament or muscle. So they can take sort of a few few little test tubes of your blood, spin it, and then put it back in, say, your jaw, which in my case would be extremely useful. And what you get is new bone. I'm, of course, wondering myself why it is that the bone's disappearing in the first place. Anybody that's got any information or links on that, I'd be interested to see. he pointed out as well that these resonances are holistic resonances because we're effectively a walking cord where millions upon millions of different frequencies of different things functioning in our body, but they all do make for a coherent whole. Perhaps best illustrated, as Tim suggested, by the science of cymatics and the beautiful patterns that come about as a result of different resonances. Somewhere up a few energy levels from us, there's a huge cymatic for each of us, which represents the total frequencies that are functioning with us. And it must be a completely stunning thing, rather like one of those Buddhist sand paintings that are done of the mandalas. So these resonances affect our entire our body, our mind, and our spirit, because all of those different levels are resonance levels. And we already went into a little bit how physical this particular kind of change could be. We don't very many of us get to experience a full range of frequencies anymore anyway. The kind of stuff that we listen to is extremely tightly constrained compared with things like a big band or a full symphony orchestra or what have you. But has been my good fortune on a couple of times in the past to experience some gong baths, which is like, in my experience, they've been tents at festivals where you can kind of go and lie on the ground and wrap yourself in a blanket or whatever. And there is a huge number of different sorts of gongs that are played around you. And so you get all the different frequencies that work right the way from your base chakra down in your perineum, right the way up through the various frequencies of the heart and the chest. And these physical organs, the organs and your body do move and vibrate as these various instruments are used. And then, of course, they get to the throat and the third eye. Some of these things, I'm told, last all night, so you can actually go to sleep in the gong bath and wake up and they perform all night, and being asleep is no different from being awake, apart from the fact that maybe we're a little bit more conscious. One of the things that Tim did in his actual workshop was get the whole room of people that were listening to his talk toning, which is making the om noise or ah or e or oo, various noises. And it is actually incredibly rewarding, mostly when you get a bunch of people together who are not used to doing this sort of work. What you get is everybody makes their own tone and the resulting noise can be pretty interesting. Perhaps unsurprisingly, at the Music Medicine Festival, the people in the room that were participating in this exercise naturally attuned themselves to the people that were around them, so that the noises we got were extremely beautiful. And it makes a whole difference. As with everything else, the power of 50 voices working together is much, much more than 50 times the power of the one voice. Again, one of the things that Tim chose to, when I asked him what we could do to use sound to improve our lives, one of the first things he alighted on, again, as so many previous guests over the last 3 years on the Dr. Rock Show, he highlighted on bathroom requisites and water. In other words, he was talking about what Annie Day referred to the other week as our personal care kits, our soap and shampoo and conditioner and antiperspirant and all these other things that we might be using. From Tim Wheater's point of view, these are similarly resonant items, and that he treats their effect on us as one of resonance and acoustics. They're not in tune with our natural bodies and need to be tested, and most of them, I suspect, disposed of. And he also highlighted on water. Again and again, we get to hear how important water is, possibly even more important than food in keeping the human body on the go. And finally, Tim said that these are important, fertile and amazing times. And in my own life, I would personally absolutely agree with that 100%, that really I can see all sorts of changes happening in me and the people around me. I'm beginning to get some kind of handle on how it is that intent and manifestation are so tightly linked together. Some really astonishing things have been happening to both to me and those I love over recent weeks. And on that kind of level, all I can feel is just this real surging optimism. As he says, important, fertile, amazing times. But at the same time, as well as being at the astonishing Old Chapel Farm for the last 10 days or so, two or three weeks back, I was on a 70-acre farm down near Carmarthen, where I stood in a meadow which had quite a lot of flowers in it, really, and round it, and the field, the hedges had been left to go fairly wild, a bit like the plot gate we heard about down in Glastonbury. So there was a lot of, it was pretty fecund, you know, everything was growing, the sun was shining, and I didn't see a single insect. There were a couple of flies in the room I was staying in, but out in the meadow, I didn't see a single bee, not a honeybee, not a bumblebee. I didn't see any hoverflies, nothing at all. And I found that pretty disturbing, but not as disturbing as I found the news that five miles down the road, unbeknownst to me, discovered really only a couple of days ago, personally, is somebody's installed what looks really like a harp installation near a little village called Capel Dewi. Capeldewi. This makes it about, like I say, 5 miles away or so from the place where I was staying. It's pretty close to Aberystwyth. And down a little side road, very, very difficult to see from the road, and I doubt whether most people, even if they went down there, would know what this thing was. But I wonder if it's just a coincidence, this close proximity of this thing. And another thing, I think that's requiring a bit of my attention is what's happening to our trees, because as a young man I remember when all of the elms disappeared. In a lot of places in the country it didn't make a lot of difference, but our established holiday route as a family was from the industrial Midlands down to the southwest, down to Cornwall, and we used to use what is euphemistically called a Roman road to do that. It's the Foss Way, it's called. It's quite a famous road, really nice and straight, and it used to be completely lined with hundreds and hundreds of mature elms, and they just disappeared in a wanner. And when I was at Old Chapel Farm, I was speaking with Kevin up there, because they've got a bit of a stunted old horse chestnut tree, a conker tree, as known to many school children, and he was telling me that that's just about finished in this country now. You could see that this particular one was dying from the crown and the edges. We're also facing trouble with our ash trees. The latest news, as far as I can tell, is from last November on the spread of this particular, it's called sudden ash dieback, I think. And we can now see it in trees all around us. We're pretty sure we could see it in the early spring. There are some ash trees that haven't dropped their ash keys, i.e. the little seeds that they form on the tips of their branches. They've, instead of dropping them as they should have done well into the spring, really, they seem to be holding on to those, some of the bigger trees. And we're seeing even in the healthier-looking trees that there's a lot of dieback at the tips of all of the branches. So at some point, we're probably going to have to face up to the fact that we're not only going to have to lose the ash tree from our landscape, which is going to make a huge difference, but that there's going to need to be a huge amount of effort put in one way or the other to making sure that whatever advantage can be gained from this situation is gained. I was talking also with a man called Tony whilst I was up at Old Chapel Farm, who looks after bees, and he's having a hell of a time keeping the various colonies working. He was telling me that he's invested maybe 50 or 100,000 bees into the woodland that surrounds these places, about 20 miles beyond Llanidloes, and so far without any result. So when I look at the bigger scale of things, I really do find myself sometimes wondering what on earth it is that human beings can do to, if you like, start to mitigate our kind of shameless behaviour over the years. But I remain absolutely convinced that we can't tell at the moment how simple some of the solutions might be to some of these things. But I do know that whatever it is that we're going to do, we need to be doing it now, really. That each of us, to our own competences and to the levels of our own knowledge, need to be starting to act and starting to take responsibility for what it is that's going on around us. I see so many absolutely marvellous things happening, things that we really wouldn't even have dreamt of 5 years ago. And it's impossible for us to tell just exactly how much effect that's going to have on the overall thing. I think of Guy Taylor and the kind of the kind of ripples he's cutting. One man working really hard. I mean, you know, poor guy finds himself in with a lot of opportunities to exercise his knowledge and the rest of it, but each of us on our own scale can at this point be making a difference to the world in which we live and the people around us, especially when we know that so much of it is happening on the kind of energetic levels that Tim Wheater was talking about. So the next little conversation I'd like to play also happened at the Music Medicine Festival down in Glastonbury. And it's with a man called Bear, who I met. It's actually an informal chat we had out in the campsite. Bear was there kind of chilling and looking around and taking part, a bit like I was. But he was a thoroughly interesting character. I wanted to talk to him because he's using kinesiology, which is the muscle testing technique that Annie Day was talking about the other week, and one that I've talked a lot about really over the years. He's using it in a practical way to help guide changes in his life, and he's also developed an extensive interest in shamanism and shamanic lore, what it is that our ancestors believed, and that's something else we'll be looking into a bit more closely in future shows, because as I consider some of the ideas that are being put forward by our shamanic forebears, I realise that they're ideas that are worth holding in mind, because again, they change the kind of vibrational level on which we're operating. Having some idea of the energetic basis from which we come can be really helpful. Now, what I quite often do with the people that I'm interviewing is we quite often have a bit of a chat before the interview starts, just to kind of, you know, get comfortable with each other. And I did this with Bear, whilst aiming towards, move towards the kinesiology part of the talk we were having. But we did end up talking fairly early on about shamanic practitioners and about power animals, and a bit about Bear's earlier explorations before it was that he got into the spiritual side of life. And actually, when I was editing it and listening to it, I thought, well, no, I think I'm going to start it a little bit early so we can hear some of that background stuff. So we kind of lunge at it really and come straight in on a conversation about retrieval of power animals, which is normally done by shamanic traveling, a technique that whilst I can't say I'm familiar with it, I have done a bit of work that way. And Bear's a bit unusual in that he managed to find his power animal under hypnotism, which is the first time I'd heard of that. So here's Dr. Rock having a chat with Bear out at the campsite outside the Music Medicine Festival in Glastonbury.
Done a bit of shamanic journey in the but I met my power animal through hypnosis.
Really?
And I actually, my power animal's a bear, that's why friends call me Bear, but I actually felt like I was inside it, and I could feel its muscles as it was moving, and its senses and everything. It was just absolutely amazing.
Brilliant, really, one with it.
Yeah, and that's the closest I've ever got to it, was more through hypnosis than journeying.
I guess that there's got to be a similarity between hypnosis and journeying, really, because the drum is a kind of hypnotic tool, isn't it?
Yeah, but when I've journeyed to meet my power animal in the past, there's not always been a drum or a drummer available, mm-hmm. So you try and do it through CDs, but they're never quite the same, because you don't get the resonance that you would off a drum and the vibration. You're just listening to the sound, I suppose, unless you've got a really good sound kit to do it through.
I think valve amplification helps myself rather than transistors.
Yes, definitely. But no, the hypnosis was just absolutely amazing.
And it just kind of arose for you, the bear, straight away.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Mm. Well, obviously I met the bear first and was playing with it and talking to it and things like that, and then all of a sudden I just morphed into the bear. It's just... wow. Stunning.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
And a real, what do you call it, a real validation.
Yes.
Of what the shamans are telling us.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we've all got these associations with natural critters.
Yep, we certainly have. Everybody's supposed to have a power animal watching over them, but I suppose a lot of people can't get in touch with it or find out what it is, unless some have to go through third parties, don't they, rather than try and make the contact themselves.
Mine's a dolphin, but what I see lots of and what I experience lots of are mice.
Right.
Loads and loads of really close encounters with mice.
Well, I've got the bear, I've got a wolf that lurks in the background protecting me, but I've also got a slug.
Really?
Yeah, and I think that's all about trying to slow you down rather than rush into everything, you know, make split decisions. Being ex-forces, that's what you had to do.
Yeah.
This is kind of making me sit back and slow down and think about things. And I currently work for Rolls-Royce, and they're a bit like that there, because you're building aero engines, you've got to take your time and make sure that you've got everything spot on.
Yeah.
Because there's lives involved, so that's kind of really helped me to slow down as well. So it's been good. Allows you to think and introspect a bit more. But yeah. Love it.
It's interesting, I find a lot of the people I know and respect who are doing shamanic work are ex-forces people.
Yes.
I can think of at least three that fought in Vietnam.
Right.
And they've sort of, so they know about that kind of warriorhood, but they've moved into the shamanic practice, which is more of the way of the peaceful warrior, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I've done quite a lot of martial arts, and obviously you're using those points to hurt people, whereas now I'm using them to fix people. And I think from a military perspective, because you're in the woods all the time, living in holes in the ground for weeks on end, you're getting a lot closer to nature, and you use the senses that you wouldn't normally use in Civvy Street, because obviously you're listening and seeing, trying to find out where your enemy is and things like that, and what's moving about you. So,
and presumably using other senses that we've forgotten about as well.
Yeah, your sixth sense comes into it a lot. You just feel like the hairs on the back of your neck, you know, so you know there's something about to happen.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I just think it generates a whole complete new awareness.
Yeah, and it is interesting, isn't it, that the points that are used to hurt are also the ones that are used to heal.
Yes, and they always say that if you teach martial arts and you know how to hurt people, you should know how to fix them as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, was that part of the original martial art training, do you think?
I think it was, years ago. I've read quite a few books that said, like, the old Japanese samurai and people like that, yes, they knew how to hurt and kill and stuff, but they also did know how to heal people.
Mm.
And then to counteract all their killing and stuff like that, they used to write poetry and paint and things like that, to, I suppose, try and get in touch with their feminine side.
Which I guess is a lot more balanced than remote flying a drone and just launching a...
Well, yeah. It's a bit like playing, I suppose, a video game then, isn't it? You're a bit removed from it.
Yeah.
And you don't realise what you're causing and what you're creating. And
my impression is that it is very like a video game, because I think because the drone obviously is unmanned, you are by definition somewhere else and managing it through a computer display.
I suppose in a way it must make it easier, if there is an easy way to kill people, because you're removed from the situation, you're not actually experiencing it, you're not on the ground. Like you say, you could be a couple of hundred miles away or whatever.
Yeah.
So I suppose that does make it easier for people to justify perhaps what they're doing.
And perhaps it results in less sort of trauma and stress for the soldier that's doing the guiding as well.
Yes, I suppose as well, and if they're doing it in some of these remote places in Pakistan and Afghanistan, that if you to put soldiers on the ground to do it, you would probably need a couple of hundred, whereas one drone can do it.
As they experienced in Vietnam, didn't they?
Yes.
That it was an impossible war for them to fight, really.
Yeah.
Because they needed more people than they... Whereas I think, as far as I gather, the VC were much more attuned to the jungle and to their environment. And so what was it that drew you to kinesiology?
Well, I have a bit of a story, because I used to kind of sit on the fence with spirituality and not believe or disbelieve. I probably felt there was something a bit more out there, but I never really pursued it, I suppose, doing the warrior bit and then doing the martial arts bit. So the martial arts was the precursor, the breaking me in gently as to getting into the more spiritual side. But my father died about 8 years ago, and I never really grieved properly for him. I put on my brave face for my sisters and mother. I never really let go myself, and that built up a lot of anger in me. And I was running a pub at the time and having to deal with village idiots and ask people to leave quietly, and I really wanted to take them around the back and show them the error of their ways. You couldn't quite do it, and that anger was building up and building up. And then I was reading book reviews in the Express newspaper. Now, I normally don't read book reviews, but it was Lorna Byrne's Angels in Your Hair, and I asked my wife, who was going into town, to get me the book, and it had a bit of a profound effect on me. And then in the pub, I had a chance conversation with somebody who said, oh, I know a medium that will sort you out. So I agreed, and then the next minute, Shane Darby, the Crystal Skull Man's come down, and there's him, me and my father crying our eyes out in the back room of the pub when it was shut, because he's clairsentient as well as being a medium, so he was feeling all the emotions from my father as well. So that obviously had quite an effect. And then another chance conversation in the pub, because I was going to go up to Shane's circle, but he was quite a distance away and it made it quite difficult to get to. So another chance conversation in the pub said, oh, my friend goes to a place just down the road, to a lady called Sally Wathen at Rainbow Bridge. So I started going there mainly just for the meditation classes and stuff that she does on a Thursday night. But from there, because she teaches healing and kinesiology and all this sort of stuff, I've been slowly expanding my horizons into healing. And that's how I got started on kinesiology. I qualified about a year ago, so I've been building up a practice part-time while in between working shifts at Rolls-Royce. But I just think kinesiology is magic.
How would you describe it to somebody who hadn't come across it before?
It's really, really difficult. It's using Chinese medicine with a little bit of Western medicine. But the main eye-opener is the client's body is telling you what is wrong with them. When you have a client come in, there are a few tests that you would do standing up to see whether they're stuck in stress or not, whether they're dehydrated, quick basic checks, mineral deficiencies. But then you would put them on a couch and do 17 muscle tests, and depending on the results of those muscle tests, it will give you pointers in certain directions as to what is wrong with them and what needs fixing. And then you use the body to clarify which one's fixing first by finding out which is the priority. And once you've found the priority, then obviously we go through and fix it. And that's mainly using the Chinese medical system, holding acupressure points, lymphatic massage and drainage, and basically rechecking afterwards to make sure that you've fixed that. And then you go back and check the other things that you picked up, and some may be fixed, others may not, so therefore you'll fix them until your client proves positive overall. But the big thing is, if you find somebody, and one of the biggest causes of illness is stress, and it doesn't necessarily have to be mental stress, it can be a sportsman overtraining, it can be somebody doing a job that they don't realise is stressing them out, but it's just mundane, working for somebody that you don't really want to be there. You know it's not your life, you know you should be doing something different. So with that, or it could be even just somebody's grief, somebody's died or whatever.
There can be a lot of stress generated at home.
Yeah, and you can get them on the couch and you can do emotional stress release on them. And you have people that crying, convulsing, getting rid of whatever it is that's stressing them out. But also, because you have to put them into a weak state to be able to do that, universal weakness we call it, while you're there you can also check them for batch flower remedies, which again is going to work on the emotions subtly and to help them overcome whatever the problem is, the stress or the grief. Still, while you've got them in weakness, you can check them for vitamin and mineral deficiencies. So again, it's the whole approach, especially for somebody in stress, because they'll have messed up their stomachs. and if you messed up your stomach, you're not getting the nutrients out of your food, so therefore you're going in the downward spiral all the time.
And the stomach and the abdomen are also important in registering stress and the like, aren't
certainly
they?
Because that's when they say, oh, you're sick to your stomach about something. But also recently people are starting to realise that your stomach is your second brain, and that obviously if that's messed up, it's sending the wrong signals upstairs to your brain, so therefore your body's getting the wrong signals, and it's a vicious never-ending circle. And the amount of people at the moment that are eating crap food, won't name any of the takeaway chains and things like that, but
you know who you are.
Yeah, and also all the rubbish that the supermarkets are selling you, and people don't realise, and they're eating it, and it's all been processed, and it's all messing your stomach up in one way or another.
It's not giving you the nutrition, is it? And it's also not, I don't think it's managing to eliminate itself from the body either, because it's almost like it's so refined that the body, which is a system for refining energy, can't refine it any further.
No, well, that's the problem. When you eat something like that and your body can't digest it and deal with it, it dumps it somewhere else in your body, and that can cause disease in that sort of place. It's okay if the body then at a later date can go and get it and process it and get rid, but what you normally find is your favourite food is normally the food that's killing you.
The thing you crave.
Yeah, so you're eating more and more of it, so therefore your body can't deal with it, so it's still dumping it wherever, and it's building up, and then all of a sudden you've got this big problem. Normally it's a bad back or something like that, and people just put it down to the back, but it could be kidneys, could be liver, could be anything like that, the way your food's dumping it, or your body's dumping the food and it's not being able to deal with it. Again, stress is linked to it as well, and that's one of the main causes of bad backs, other than physically tearing or slipping a disc or something like that.
It's much more often to do with stress and diet and stuff, isn't
it? Yeah, it is, because it's all linked and it's all messing you up slowly but surely, we just don't realise.
But it's funny, isn't it, that your inner you, the entity, whatever it is, the energy source that you're questioning by using kinesiology, knows that this is going on. Like you say, it's almost like you call it the secondary brain, the digestive system and stuff, knows more than your primary brain does. And kinesiology is tremendously successful at, first of all, identifying intolerances and allergies, and then clearing them up. I think it's pretty amazing that it can tell the difference between an intolerance and an allergy. Have you, have you discovered that to be the case?
Definitely, yes. It's just amazing. And you can teach people with quite basic stuff how to, when they're in Asda's or wherever, one of the supermarkets, and they're choosing food, you can quickly test yourself to see whether it's good for you or not, or medicine or anything. If you was to stand upright and shut your eyes, and then the way to test yourself first is to say, depending on your sex, am I a woman? And if you are a woman, you'll go in a certain direction, your body will move in a certain direction. And then you ask yourself, if I'm a man, and because you're a woman, you'll move in a different direction. So now you know what your positive and negative is. So then if you pick something up and hold it in your hand, whether it be food or medicine, and ask yourself, do I need this, or is this good for me? And then you'll move one way or the other, telling you either positive or negative. And obviously if it's negative, then you walk away and leave it alone. But there's just all, like, even if you had a big decision to make, doesn't have to be necessarily food or minerals or something like that, but if you have a decision to make, as long as you ask it straightforward yes or no answers, it can help you to work out the solution to your problem.
It's important, the yes no thing, isn't it? You don't want to ask questions that require more complicated answers. But a series of yes-no questions can establish quite complex things.
Yes, you can narrow it down, you know, to what the real cause is. So this is a bit like a pendulum asking yes and no's with that. But
It is. You are using your body as a pendulum, aren't you, really? Whether you're using the arm for testing. Yeah. I actually haven't come across that idea of asking, whether you're a man, ask, am I a man? And you're talking about feeling your body swaying either backwards or forwards or side to side.
Yep.
That's very good.
Yes,
because that's even more pendulum. Yeah. Even more pendulum-like.
Yeah, I mean, and also that you can do that subtly in a supermarket. Whereas if you start pulling pendulums and things out, and whizzing around, people are going to think you're some sort of witch or something like that, and you might get thrown out the store. So yeah, it's a subtle way of working out a lot of things.
And they are somehow, it's like it's reaching, it's finding answers that are beyond our conditioning and our education and our recognition and everything. Which is absolutely astonishing.
It is. And I mean, take a point, my wife unfortunately has been ill for years, and I've not been able to help her because I've never been into kinesiology and stuff, but now I am, I can start to help her. But she's got to the point where she probably had candida years ago and suffered with a bit with thrush and things like that, and women tend to get it more than men because long-term pill use and things like that can bring it on. But candida is a build-up of bad bacteria in the stomach, which eventually overtakes the good and then causes all sorts of other stuff, like IBS is the beginning. With my wife, she had endometriosis because that spread, the candida spread out of the stomach and then started going around the body. And I'm sure that it's probably linked to the current liver problem she's got as well, because most people can fight off liver disease if they're healthy, but if you're not healthy and you haven't got the wherewithal to do it, and therefore the disease takes over. And it's quite a long process to detox and get rid of the, you won't ever get totally get rid of the candida, but bring the balance back so the good bacteria comes back up, because it keeps the bad bacteria in check. And then once you've done that, then everything starts to come together for you. So all these women that are going out doing Weight Watchers and things like that, they got no real chance of losing weight. They may do initially, but it'll come back because their stomachs are still full of bad bacteria and they haven't addressed the real problem first. And once you start getting on the road of detoxing yourself, then you naturally lose weight anyway.
As you do when you start eating healthier foods rather than the ultra-refined so-called foods that are being given. The thing that's interesting, isn't it, because what we're talking about there is a cumulative thing over many years.
Yes.
As the start is probably something relatively innocuous and easy to deal with, but it becomes an entrenched problem which puts stress on other parts of the system, which makes it look like a much more complicated problem than it is.
Yes.
And, I mean, even if your GP could identify what's going on, and they don't seem to me to even bother to try, it would be very difficult for them to work out what order in which to do things, whereas the kinesiology, testing your inner you, reveals not only the nature of what it is that's going on, but what needs to be done first.
That's right. Yeah, and not only that, I mean, how many times has somebody with IBS or a stomach problem gone to a doctor and he's asked them what they ate, looked at their diet, how much water are they drinking?
Not at all.
Correct. And their answer to things is when something gets really bad, like you get loads of gallstones or kidney stones, not so much with kidneys, you can't take them away, but they take the gallbladder away, which in itself is causing an imbalance, when really they should be looking at the diet. And there are natural products that can help break down the gallstones. Yes, it'll take a period of time, but hopefully then you'll start passing them and getting rid of them. But also they believe that candida in the stomach, eventually, if it's left unchecked, is one of the things that helps to start cause cancers.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe...
Cancer is kind of your last-ditch attempt to tidy up stuff inside, isn't it?
Yeah, if you don't get that right, then it's curtains, but... I believe that anything, most illnesses that you get are caused naturally, so therefore in nature there is a natural way to combat them and heal them. Okay, if you get exposed to radiation for some reason or other, that's not really a natural way of life, and it doesn't happen all the time, so it's a bit harder to get rid of something like that, if you can get rid of it at all. But if it's something that either through food, water, because of all the rubbish they're putting in our water nowadays, even stuff that you're breathing in that they're supposedly pumping into the air, it's all affecting you and it's all toxins. But in a lot of cases there are natural ways to get rid of those toxins, so you reduce the effects that it's having on you. It's just being educated and finding out what they are.
Yeah, because our body mostly has ways of dealing with these things, as long as they're dealt with fairly promptly. But I mean, I think it's true to say that a lot of the huge amount of people's problems are to do with food and eating inappropriately. And a large amount of what's left is down to not drinking enough water, which is another big thing with kinesiology, isn't it? That's my kinesiologists were trying for years to get me to drink more water. It worked in the long run.
Kinesiology is the big drinking water is the big key, because A, you're hydrating your body, and everybody thinks drinking tea and coffee is hydrating your body. It's not, it's dehydrating, it's having the opposite effect. Your body's 70% water, so if you're not getting enough of it to replenish what you're sweating and wasting out, then your body's on a downward spiral anyway. You need to have at least 8 to 10 ounce glasses of water a day just to maintain your body at its normal levels. So if you're doing lots of exercise, then you're going to need an awful lot more water to replenish that.
And if you're drinking lots of coffee, you'll need water to replenish the water.
Correct.
And Coca-Cola. I was really shocked to find that Coca-Cola actually makes you, it consumes substantially more water or fluid than it gives you.
Well, unfortunately, Coca-Cola and these other soda pop type drinks are the big no-nos in life because of all the rubbish that they're filling them with. Mm. Especially the diet stuff. So all the women are on the diet stuff because they think it's doing them a favour, when in actual fact it's having an adverse reaction because of all the aspartame and sweeteners and stuff in it.
It's probably doing you even more harm than the other Coke, which isn't to say that you should be drinking that instead.
They reckon the best thing to use Coke for is cleaning your toilet, because it normally dissolves all the rubbish off the side of your toilet and then flush it away.
But really there is only water, isn't there?
Yes.
That's what we need to be drinking.
There are other things, I suppose, that you could drink as well as water, like coconut water and things like that, because that's a natural rehydrating fluid after you've done strenuous exercise. They believe it definitely works better than things like Lucozade and stuff like that, but just gives you a sugar rush. And then all these other sports drinks like Red Bull and stuff like that, they're definitely something to stay away from, because again it's just creating this huge sugar rush in your body, and then after the sugar's gone, you've got this big downward spiral and a slump until your body gets the next sugar rush. So it's yo-yoing all the time instead of being at a natural balance.
How does proper fruit juice fall into that? Because obviously it's distilled water in fruit, but obviously you've got the fruit sugars and things in there as well.
But they're natural. It's when you start adding all the added sugars that things start to go wrong. And again, it's everything within moderation. Point in case, I read that oily fish is good for you. So for a 2-week period, I was having, because I was on early morning shifts, it was easy just to put a bit of herring and tomato sauce on a piece of toast and then go to work. But I've done it for 2 weeks every morning. And then the result of that is, because herring's high in purine, I got gout. So it's everything in moderation. To get rid of the gout, I was having to drink neat cider vinegar. And that done the trick.
Cider vinegar is another simple, cheap miracle thing to be doing, isn't it?
It certainly is. I wouldn't advise drinking it neat, though, because it does make you want to gag. And now I dilute it.
I think just a spoonful in a glass of water is good enough, isn't it?
Yes.
That's another interesting point, in fact, is that we don't need anything in quantity. Our system is a homeopathic system that responds to very small quantities of things.
Yes. And the other thing, especially for women, is half a lemon in lukewarm water every morning, because that detoxes the body and kills candida, and also it helps burn fat, so they're going to lose weight. And it's just a healthy way of waking up in the morning and getting a lot of vitamin C into your body, so you don't get ill as much anyway.
And we are here confusing in our society anyway signals that are actually signals for thirst as signals for hunger. So I now start the day with a couple of pints of water, actually.
Well, I read something recently about how to avoid heart attacks, because they believe that heart attacks occur early in the morning up until about 12 o'clock at midday. And that before you go to bed at night, you should drink a 10-ounce glass of water. And then a glass of water before or with every meal. And when you get up in the morning, have 2 glasses of water. and that staves off the chances of having a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I never knew until fairly recently.
No, that's news to me. And of course it stops you from feeling so hungry. Getting a couple of glasses of water inside you before breakfast.
Yes.
And the lemon juice in water, I like that as well. That's alkalizing the body, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Even though lemons are actually acid.
When it hits the stomach, apparently there's a chemical reaction that takes place that changes it into alkali. And also, if your body's alkali, there's less chances of getting cancer. Most of our bodies are acidic because of the meat we eat and all the other rubbish. And to turn it back the other way so it's just boring on alkali prevents a lot of cancers and things.
And the cider vinegar helps do that as well?
Yeah, that has the same similar sort of reaction in the body and changes it to alkali as well. But coming back to the water thing, if you're drinking lots of water, your body's 70% water, and your body is using, and your nervous system is using electromagnetic pulses to send messages all around your body. So if you're dehydrated, those messages get inhibited because they can't flow properly. You're not completing the circuit. So as soon as you start rehydrating yourself, you'll start to feel healthier anyway, because your body's getting the messages through to where it needs to go to restore factory settings, if you like, and get it back to normal. So water is just unbelievable. The only problem with it nowadays is what comes out of the tap, and even some of the stuff you get in the bottles isn't what you think it is.
No, and the plastic bottles are, of course, themselves a problem.
Yes.
But we know we can make a certain amount of difference to the water by blessing it and by giving it positive feelings. This has been demonstrated.
Yes.
I personally am happy to drink tap water as long as I know there's not fluoride in it, for example, which I think is a lot harder to clear up.
Yes, and that point in case not so long ago, I think it was about 10 years ago, where down in Devon, Cornwall, Camelford way, they put aluminium in the wrong tank, or too much aluminium in, and nearly poisoned off the Devon and Cornwall in the water supply. So you just don't know what they're playing at, and why would you want to put things like that in water?
Many cases, if you look around, you can still find local springs where you can gather water for drinking and the rest. Obviously you can use the other water for washing and the like, although it does have to be said that probably showering and bathing in water that's full of fluoride doesn't help.
No, because your body still ingests it and it still gets into your system. That's the other thing with all the stuff that people are spraying on their bodies, the aluminium that's coming off the aerosols and things like that. People don't realise, but it is ingested in through the pores of the body. And the makeup that you're putting on and things like that, and that also has a detrimental effect in toxifying the body,
which makes it all of these different things make it all that much more amazing that kinesiology is so good at identifying not only what the specific problem is but what to do about it.
Yes.
I mean, I've personally had several successes with kind of people treating me with kinesiology, and I talk with my kinesiologists a lot, and they're pretty successful, because things like asthma can be a response to food and allergies and intolerances and things.
Yeah, certainly can. And they're even starting to believe that ADHD and things like autism are food allergies. Possibly something that the mother ate while she was pregnant and is passed on to the child, or it could be something that the child is eating, or a vitamin and mineral that the child hasn't got that's causing similar sorts of effects, whether it be autism, ADHD or whatever.
So if you have a real little person, a real youngster, can you use kinesiology on them? How would you set about testing her?
It's difficult with real youngsters, and you can even use it on animals, but you can't use it direct. But what you can do is get a lock of hair. You have to fix who you're going to be using as a surrogate first, so there's no problems with them. And then you place the hair in the pocket, and they will test exactly as the animal or the child. And then from that you can gather what's up with the child, and hopefully then start to treat the child, so it, and the animal to that matter as well, so it starts to get better.
Great, so you're talking about using a more mature human.
Yes.
And you do the kind of the basic thing that you described earlier to make sure that
it goes for old folk as well, because some old folk, they're not going to want to be laid out on a couch and somebody pulling them around and poking them, so you can do it with them as well, especially when you're looking for things like batch flower remedies and stuff like that. because then you can discern what they need and give it to them. But also when you're doing it on a surrogate client, there's a bit of a natural, I'm trying to think of the word, transference, if you like, to the actual patient that needs it through the hair in the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a subliminal, subtle effect on them as well. So they do get the benefit from it in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't overstate kinesiology enough, the magic it is. And the problem is, most people don't know about it.
No, I've recommended it to lots of people who've got problems, and to GPs, I must admit, because, again, they don't have a lot of time to ask a lot of questions.
No.
I'm not sure they know what questions to ask. And if they were trained in kinesiology, they'd be getting information on the questions to ask. Mm. And
I had a bit of a laugh once. I went to a hospital with my wife with her IBS, and they were trying to work out what it was, and what they wanted her to do was go on a starvation diet and then reintroduce things a little bit at a time until they worked out which one was upsetting her. And I said to the doctor, oh, I can check for that with kinesiology. And I just got this look that says, who the hell do you think you are? Given his due, he actually looked it up on their PubMed system on their computer, and it told him all about it. But then right at the bottom it says not recognised by the NHS. So straight away he says, no.
It's really important to recognise that these people are paid to tell us some things, and equally they're paid not to tell us others.
Well, if you believe what they tell you about how the pharmaceutical companies put these doctors through training and college and stuff like that, it's quite easy to see that they get blinkered and that they believe then everything that the pharmaceutical companies tell them.
7 years of deep conditioning.
Yes, and so they're not going to start looking at alternative therapies, although there are a few nowadays that are starting to wake up and using it to complement Western medicine.
Well, I'm thinking it must be the same with doctors as it is with lawyers and judges and policemen. There must be doctors there who enter the profession for the right reason and who actually genuinely do want to make people better.
Yes.
And such people must be starting to notice that it's not necessarily working as well for them. And some of them must be starting to notice that people who are using complementary practices are getting what can only be described as miraculous results.
Yes. There's a few people that I've heard about that have used kinesiology or some other method of healing themselves and have then gone back to the doctor who said, oh yeah, fine, brilliant, whatever, if it's working, do it. But he's not saying that it's the way to go. And one of our case studies in kinesiology was a gentleman who was on medicine so bad that as soon as he mentioned it to a doctor, they used to go,
it's not helpful from the doctor, is it?
Apparently if you're on it for longer than 3 months, it actually kills you. But it was the only thing that would sort out pain in his legs. And he came to us in the October, and we worked on him within the class situation. And we started to work out there were a number of things wrong with him, as well as a traumatic experience he had about 10 years prior when all this started to trigger. So we sorted him out for that. But then as we went on with the kinesiology, he was going longer and longer without having to go back to the doctors for the medication. And in the end, the doctor was ringing him and saying, well, you haven't been back on your 3 monthly point for more medication. He says, well, I don't need it. I'm not in pain. And now he's totally off it, and yet he was on it on and off for 5 or 6 years, and it was slowly killing him.
Yeah.
And now he feels
so good.
And
they knew it was.
Yeah,
they knew it was. They're prescribing something to him that they knew would kill him.
Yes.
It's quite shocking in itself.
It is. Although it was sorting out his pain, or he thought it was sorting out his pain, it was probably masking it. Mm. But, yeah, they were actually killing him, toxifying him with this medicine.
It makes me think that it's actually quite important that people who have been, you know, under the care of the Not Healthy Service and have not got results,
yes,
and have then gone somewhere else and got results, it's pretty important that they go back to the doctor and show him. I know that quite often what they say is, oh, it must have been a misdiagnosis or the machine wasn't working properly or whatever, but nonetheless, the more people that go back to doctors with a miraculous...
But the thing is, like him, the trauma he had 10 years ago was the trigger for his illness. And we had another gentleman who came to us because he couldn't sleep. He was having about 2-3 hours sleep a night, real bad pains in one of his shoulders. And it wasn't until his second treatment, and I asked him, how long has this been going on? And he said 25 years. So I said to him, what happened 25 years ago? And he had to think. And then he said, oh, it was horse riding. First time he'd ever been on a horse. It was a big horse. Got on it, thought it was nice and calm and stable. But the next minute it took off towards a 6-foot fence. So he thought, rather than go over the fence with the horse, he would throw himself off the back. And he went down on that shoulder. But the whole trauma of that event and the body retaining the memory of that injury, he'd brought forward with him. And once he disclosed this, and we'd done emotional stress release on him, taking him back to the time of the actual accident, he was able to go to sleep straight away. We actually put him to sleep in the class because we calmed down his fight and flight mechanism. And it was a good job his wife was with him, because she had to drive him home. But she said he got home about 10 o'clock that night and went to bed and didn't wake up until 8, 9 o'clock the following morning. And that's the first time in 25 years.
He must have been such a happy chappy.
I mean, his sleep did improve after that. He was getting 4 to 5 hours and he had to come back for another session, but now he's sleeping normally. Mm-hmm. But you just wouldn't relate the two 25 years ago to today, yeah. And that's his problem.
And a single physical trauma as well, leading to 25 years of sleeplessness.
I think he was probably, I don't know, 18, 20 at the time, so I suppose as a youngster it would have been pretty scary, because it was a big horse and apparently it was really bolting for this fence, and that would have been scary enough, but then having to throw yourself off of it. Mm. Yeah.
And of course sleep itself's really important for the body's detoxing and relaxing, sorting out mental, physical and all sorts of stress.
Yes.
You need your whatever it is your body needs, 6, 7, 8 hours.
Yep.
So you can see how the problem becomes embedded and you're going to again generating other problems as a result of not sleeping.
And also from a spiritual point of view, if you're not getting your sleep, where they say that you may go out of body while you're sleeping or into real deep sleep where you get all your messages and inspiration and stuff from, you're obviously not getting that either. Mm. So yeah, sleep is a big one. I know myself, if I don't get my 8 hours, I don't get beautiful, I get uglier and I get miserabler as well and meaner. So I need my 8 hours sleep, and it's quite important.
I think you definitely function more accurately and efficiently after proper amounts of sleep, because I didn't used to get a lot of sleep when I was working in industry and under a lot of stress. They were very restless nights, but I do now.
Yes.
I now sleep pretty thoroughly all the way through. And it makes it a lot easier to get on with other people. It also makes it a lot less likely that you're going to start generating bad eating habits and...
or even just general mistakes. I know in the army you sometimes could go 4 or 5 days with no sleep, but at the end of those 4 or 5 days your eyeballs are on your chin and you were starting to make mistakes. Mm. And you had to stop because it was getting dangerous. Mm. Not just for yourself but for others as well. Mm. And even if it was only a couple of hours, you would have to get some sleep.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. I use the power nap thing. I must admit, I try to get sort of 20 minutes sleep in the afternoon. And in fact, that's something that I've always, even again when I was in industry, I used to go and sleep in the car for 20 minutes at dinner time. I actually get myself out the way of it all.
I used to do that when I was repping. Mm. Yeah.
And it kind of, it means that you're not building up your stress throughout the day, are you? It means you're kind of resetting yourself to zero a little bit halfway through.
Yeah, they definitely reckon that the power nap works and that they get more out of people in the second half of a working day than you would beforehand.
That's definitely true of me, because if you don't let me go and have a nap, I will be tending to be nodding off all afternoon.
Yes.
Actually, this distance in time thing is very interesting as well. I was listening to a shamanic practitioner. He's an American guy, and his name is Dr. William Martin, I think. And he was saying that he can see auras, and he looks at them very briefly with permission and can see everything he needs to see them. And he said it's a really intense experience that would drive a lot of people crazy. But what he said was that actually nearly everybody who comes to him for healing, the original damage was done before the age of 7.
Yes. Sometimes it's even done in the past life. So I know I've had a past life as a Celtic chieftain, going off to fight a battle that we knew we couldn't win, but we had to go. And I got a sword cut on my right shoulder before they took my head off. But that's always the shoulder now when I'm stressed that plays up, and all up the side of the right side of my neck as well. So I know when I'm stressed, because that starts to play up. So I know then I've got to go and sit and meditate or do something to reduce the stress levels.
Again, useful little hint there that if you've got something that you recognise as being a stress indicator in yourself, you get the chance to respond to it rather than allow it to build up.
Yeah. And some people don't realise and it just builds up and builds up. There's another gentleman that came to see me, his wife wasn't sure whether she had been diagnosed with breast cancer. It was still going through the tests. His brother was dying of asbestosis, and both arms and all his back had locked up with the stress. And doing emotional stress release on him, again with kinesiology, the first session freed everything except his right arm from his elbow to his wrist. And the second session actually got rid of that as well. And then I combined it with a bit of energy therapy, spiritual healing, whatever you want to call it. And that just seemed to sort whatever might have still been remaining and got rid of that as well.
So what sort of techniques are you using to manifest the emotional stress relief? Because it is another major problem, isn't it?
Okay. What you normally do is you have to put the person in what we call universal weakness. So you get them to think about what the problem is. And you'll know if you're using an arm as a muscle test, it'll drop, it'll go weak. Mm-hmm. And then you tap the ankles together and then pull them apart. And that locks them in weakness. So while you've got them locked in weakness, there's 2 points on the front of the forehead that you hold and then a point on the shoulder. So they're thinking about it. It's bringing all the blood back to the front of the head again. And also it's releasing whatever the problem is through this point on the arm and out of the arm and away. Mm-hmm. It could be any number of things that they may need. There might be just one thing they need to think about, or it could be six. You don't really need to know what it is, which is another beauty of kinesiology. You don't need to be a psychotherapist or whatever. You don't need to talk them through it. You just say, think about it until you can't think about it anymore. And then I try and get them to force it a little bit. And if they still can't think about it, then you know that's gone and you move on to the next thing until that's gone and so on and so on. But you know when they haven't got rid of something, because when you're doing it, you can feel the point on the arm pulsing. And if there's still something there, the arm's still pulsing, they say, oh no, it's gone. But what it really is they don't want to go there. And now you come into the real nitty-gritty problem and you'll say, there's still something else. A woman I've done recently, it was a death of her stepfather. They were really close. But she didn't want to go there because it was a bit raw. It happened fairly recently. But when she did go there and let the grief out, because you could tell she was crying and sobbing and all the rest, it done her a world of favours. But she was suffering with a bad back.
It's funny, isn't it, that sometimes when the individual that's being treated can't express the emotion, the weeping, crying, whatever, it's actually the kinesiologist that ends up doing it.
It's a shame I hadn't had kinesiology at the time of my father's death, because then I would have probably realised and maybe been able to act a bit sooner.
So how do you find people respond to the kinesiology when they first come across it?
I would have said that 90% of people do see a benefit in it. There's obviously the 10% who may have been suffering real long-term illness or pain that believe that, oh, they've been once and you haven't fixed it. But what you have to do, you have to start building on a base first. So when they come the first time, it may be that you're sorting the stomach and that out and trying to rebalance that or reducing the stress levels, and you may run out of time to do anything else. So they need to come back for subsequent sessions, so then you can actually start getting in and getting right down into the nitty-gritty of fixing the longer-term problem. But you've got to start somewhere. I mean, on average, my sessions would take 2 hours. There's a lot of other people only do an hour or 40 minutes, but I find that to come in, to talk to the patient, to get the details, and then to start working on them, and especially if it's fixing emotions first, and then going on to fix the actual physical things, it takes a good 2 hours to
do. That's the kind of setup, isn't it? You won't have to spend so much of that time the next time the individual comes.
No, of course, you can get straight into the nitty-gritty and work it down, do lots more tests on vitamins and minerals and deficiencies and stuff like that.
And do you use boxes of materials for doing that?
Yes, I've got test kits that you can get from the vitamin manufacturers, and there's also a place in Cornwall that does food, like energetic food in glass vials.
Yeah.
And then you can use that for testing for allergies and stuff like that.
Whereas I think they're fantastic, because effectively you as the trained kinesiologist do some research on all the stuff that's in the test kits.
Yes.
And then once you're in physical contact with the testee, their body effectively knows what you know about the stuff in the box, and
yes.
So it can respond to your...
Tells you whether it's good or bad. Yeah.
Yeah. And do you put this stuff on the bit just below the belly button?
It can be anywhere on the body, or sometimes we get them to hold it in the hand, depending if they're stood up. We will get them to hold it in the hand, especially if you're food allergy testing. Because, yes, I got the test kits, but I also take them out into my kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And gluten is one of the big things nowadays, because they're putting more gluten in bread to keep it fresher. It's having real adverse effects on people and their stomachs. And then, again, they're not aware of it. And once you educate them and try and get them onto other sorts of bread... And stay away from the gluten and the yeast, especially for women with candida again, because you're feeding the candida. It just starts to work absolutely amazing.
And I've started to think that from the number of people who are intolerant to gluten and wheat and yeast,
yes.
That it's probably not that good for any of us.
Probably not, unless I think if you go back to the old wheats and you start eating spelt bread and stuff like that and sourdough bread, because they're made the old ways and there's not as many additives and stuff in them.
Yeah.
But all these quick slice loaves and things are just horrendous.
And it's difficult to get the old wheats now as well, because they have become part of the Codex Alimentarius controls, and it's now illegal apparently to hand seeds of these old wheats about.
Yes.
No, that's really grand, Bear.
It is. But unfortunately, a lot of these things are more expensive than the cheap stuff.
They are.
That's always the way, isn't it?
Yeah.
So people on tight budgets might struggle, but there's always a case of going out and growing your own, because at least you know what you've put on it and how you've grown it.
Yeah.
It'll be twice as tasty as what it is in the supermarket.
And also, I think it might
non-GMO.
Non-GMO. It might also be helpful to add that I've found personally that even... because a lot of the healthier foods, I used to be a real meat pie and Guinness man, you know, and
yes.
That's what I lived off, really. And it took me... You get to really like and want the things that you really like and want. And
yeah.
When you try new stuff, your body doesn't respond necessarily very positively to start with.
No.
But my own experience seems to suggest that if you eat something four or five times and it doesn't actually doesn't kill you or make you sick,
yeah.
Then you will get to like it. That's how you got to like the things that you like in the first place.
Correct.
And so a lot of it's to do with simplification, isn't it? And eating food that is not so refined that there's nothing left for the body to use in it.
No, it's quite right. And a lot of these skin conditions that you see are either triggered by stress and or food allergies. And people don't know what the allergy is, so they carry on eating it. And as we said before, it's normally their favourite food, so... they're building up the toxicity in the body, so it's making things worse. And then the stress is bringing it out even more.
Yeah.
So, again, it's really important what you're eating. And it's all right for me now saying this and preaching this. I used to be the same as everybody else 5 or 6 years ago. I'd have been eating all the junk food and all the crap that comes out of the supermarkets. But now I've awakened and been educated. We try and stay away from it as much as possible.
Yeah.
But it's hard sometimes. But even as long as you start doing the basic things like drinking loads and loads of water and trying to stay off the tea and coffee, at least you're making a start and giving your body a chance.
Yeah, well, you're giving it a chance to actually to get rid of the toxins that you're pouring in one end, aren't you?
That's right.
Mm. So is there anything else you think people should think about as a basic way of changing the way they feel about the world?
There is, but I think that's a total and utter another session. I think there's just so much on... going on out there, and so much illusion that people have bought into, that if you get rid of some of the illusions, especially the things like you have to have the biggest telly and the biggest computer and all the EMF that that's giving off and that's making people ill as well, and the stresses, therefore, that you have to go and get the best job and do the longest hours to get the most money to be able to afford all these things. Basically, it's just a whole lifestyle thing. My wife cracks up with me because I keep saying I want to go and get myself a log cabin in the woods and do the off-grid thing. And she's going, well, I want my creature comforts. I couldn't do that. Well, fine. Maybe you have to go and do your journey and I have to go and do mine. But it'd be nice just to be able to turn around and give the finger to all these people that want a piece of you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And as has just come out recently with, I can't remember if it's E.ON or one of the big... EDF, one of the big electrical companies, have been ripping people off for 3 years, but only just admitted it in recently because they've had a whacking great fine because of it. And they're not the only ones, they're all doing it.
And the solution to all of those problems is to find them and leave them trading.
Yes.
Which isn't increasing the moral standing at all, no. I don't think.
But unfortunately, all these governments and people are backing them because they've got shares and stuff in them. So,
well,
although you think they've had a slap on the wrist, they probably haven't because it's peanuts to them.
Yeah, and that's how they're making their money now, is out of penalties and fines and just endless.
Yes.
And I basically say not just you don't need the biggest telly, you don't need a telly at all. I really do think that telly induces a whole lot of stress.
Yes.
And
cabbage-like attitude to life as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people out there that believe Coronation Street and Emmerdale are real.
That's really, yeah.
That's scary.
You know, a long, long time ago, when the Crossroads Motel burnt down, they used to be running the stories kind of in the tabloid papers, and there's a, I can't remember which was which, the actor, one of them was Noel Gordon, and one of them was Meg Mortimer, so one of them was the character, the other was the actress, and they were saying, you know, that the motel was going to burn down and all of that, and it did. And the more enlightened of the viewers sent flowers to the ITV station that was broadcasting it. But apparently hospitals all over the country were receiving flowers because of this dead character.
Yeah.
People thought it was that real.
It's just
and
amazing.
The thing is, you don't know that that's what you're doing.
No.
If somebody asked you, you know, well, you know, is it a story or is it actual? You'd say, well, it's just a story, but that's not how your body's responding. No. The actual stress, I think, that you get subjected to, even from the phone ringing, let alone from the kind of stuff that's coming out of the television, is as real as if you were experiencing the stuff that you're watching.
And if you feel like that because of a drama, just imagine what's getting subvertedly put into your brain through the adverts. And again, people are rushing out and buying things because they've been told on the telly it's the best thing to do.
I think, again, it might be a useful practice for people to consider not watching the television for 7 days, and then trying and watching a bit of it and seeing how different they feel about it.
I was in South Africa for 2 years as a kid because my parents emigrated over there. And because there was no television at the time because of apartheid, you had to sit and talk to each other and play games with each other and educate yourself, you know, in a family unit. Whereas now, little Johnny's up in his room, little Samantha's in hers, and the two parents are possibly in the same room watching telly, but she's probably watching Emmerdale and he's in playing on the computer or something.
Yeah.
And they never meet, even for meal times. It's as they're passing each other on the stairs or
even
whatever.
Even to sit in front of the telly together.
Yes.
My family always used to sit and watch Doctor Who together when I was young. But now, like you say, they've managed to separate us into different rooms. And I hear there is now a television available, which with a special pair of glasses and some earphones, you can watch one show and the individual sitting next to you on the settee can be watching another show.
Sad, isn't it?
Very spooky, because that does show you as well how much stuff can be hidden in the signal.
And of course, with these smart TVs, you don't know whether they're putting cameras in them.
They certainly are putting cameras in them. It's, So,
whole different subject.
As is the shamanism thing as well, which I know you're starting to investigate. So it'd be great to hear how that goes, because I'm sure we'll meet again.
Yeah, no, brilliant. Sure we will.
But it's because I just sort of started recording it. I'll say that I've been talking to Bear about kinesiology at the Music and Medicine Festival just outside Glastonbury. And thank you very, very much for your time.
No problem. Nice to talk to you.
Brilliant.
That was Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra playing Junk on the Radio from their new CD, talking about the weather. And this is peoplesinternetradio.com. Before that, we were listening to Bear talking about kinesiology and a bit about shamanism and healing. Again, he alighted straight away on rehydration and the quality of it, recommended coconut water. We heard Annie Day recommending willow water the other day, which I am now drinking, and it is, I must admit, a very fine-tasting water. It's generally got all the stuff it says it has in it. It's probably going to be helpful as well, carrying, as it does, apparently, some absorbable calcium for me and a little bit of salicylic acid from the willows underneath which it flows. And Annie also recommended spring water for me. It was the first thing, given kinesiology, that my body came up with, was that it needed more water, but most of all, its emphasis was that the quality needed to be improved. So I've now found some friends of mine who've got spring water coming out their taps, and they're happy for me to turn up and help myself to some of that, so I'll be able to drink the willow water and the spring water, which would be great, just what the doctor ordered, as they say. Also, Bear highlighted on personal care kits again, and on makeup, and we had a glance in talk as well about cleaning products, which is another major menace which affects, as Tim Wheater put it, our kind of resonance, our kind of musical notes that we're singing, but also they affect the way our innards work. And it's easy to get sanguine, isn't it, to get kind of like, forget about the fact that the not healthy service is actually prescribing medicines to people to get rid of the pain. But in one of the cases that Bear was talking about, they knew that these medicines were going to kill the guy. Well, I suppose, you know, if you're going to get rid of the pain in the legs, that's a good way of doing it, as Eddie, isn't it? They knew it was killing him. That was very odd indeed. And also, Bear came up with an example of a guy that got hurt in a horsing accident sort of 25 years ago, and the kinesiology managed to pinpoint that really pretty quickly as a source of his disease. In his case, he wasn't able to sleep regularly or well. And the kinesiology, this questioning of the human subconscious or whatever it is that's going on, went straight to that as a source of that particular disease and enabled the class to basically sort it out, so that now the man, after 25 years of getting only two or three hours kip a night, is now able to sleep normally. And of course, Annie told us a similar story of a man who'd had a skiing accident when he was away, I think with the school or whatever it was, and he'd had a fall and the tip of the ski had gone through his hip and left him, as Bear described it, that the body retains the memory of the accident and builds a whole load of stresses and diseases around it. And as with Bear's example, with Annie's example, the kinesiology went first straight away to that as something that needed to be rearranged before anything else could be sorted out. And kinesiologists are rife with these stories, it has to be said. It really is uncanny. Even things that the client suspects that nobody else knows about are revealed by this questioning technique by an individual who's quite often a total stranger. So now we've got a little bit of synchro, me and synchro, because Bear mentioned the batch flower remedies there. We've mentioned them quite a lot. It was one of the first healing modalities that I came across as I drifted towards complementary therapies rather than the NHS. And I like the batch flower remedies a lot. So this is a little bit of an introductory chat that I had with Synchro. They're just coming back into our lives as she takes out a box and blows the dust off it. I know it's something that she really enjoys doing. And as I say, they are the story of how they came about is a pretty subtle and interesting story, but they also do have subtle and interesting effects on individuals. So here's Synchro and the Doctor chatting about batch flower remedies. It looks like we're going to be running a little bit over tonight, but it doesn't matter because I see from the schedule there's nobody on after me. Back with you in about 30 minutes or so. Here I am with Synchro, and because several people who I've been talking to in recent months about healing and energy and one thing and another have mentioned the batch flower remedies, or the Bach flower remedies as I always prefer to call them, but batch is apparently more correct. I thought I'd have a chat with Synchro here about who Edward Bach was and what the flower remedies are, how they're made and how they're used. So thanks very much for joining me, Synchro.
No problem.
So who was this Edward Bach then? Was he the first, as far as we know, to come up with flower essences?
He may well have been. He may well have been. I think he was one of the first to come up with a system of flower essences that he claimed was complete in the treatment of human beings, people.
Mm-hmm. And where did he start? Where did he come from?
Well, before he developed the remedies, the flower remedies, he was apparently a highly successful bacteriologist and homeopathic physician. And he had a successful Harley Street practice, which he gave up in 1930 when he was aged 43, and he devoted the last years of his relatively short life to the search for a simpler, more natural method of treatment that did not require anything to be destroyed or altered. That was his aim.
I mean, bacteriologists and homeopathists, that's an interesting combination, isn't it? People nowadays would find that difficult to swallow. But I guess in those days, that's what we had was homeopathic hospitals. I know the NHS was originally founded around homeopathic hospitals, presumably before pharmaceuticals became big.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, for some reason he chose to leave a nice little earner by the sound of it. And so how did he come across the flower remedies? How did he determine what it was they were for?
Well, apparently he did quite a bit of travelling in that time around this country, mainly, I think. England, he was based in Oxfordshire in England, and I think he took some forays into Wales as well. And he was looking for the plants that would answer the quest he'd set himself, that wouldn't need anything doing to them, that they would act directly, simply by taking the essence from the flower, that they would act directly and would supply all the needs that he had to treat people.
Mm-hmm. So he started off with, he discovered first of all 12, didn't he?
Yes, that's right. He wrote a lovely little book called The 12 Healers and Other Remedies. And I think he thought, perhaps initially, that those 12 were going to be sufficient. But as he looked into it, he discovered that he needed more than that. And he ended up with a full set, which he said, like I said, was a complete system of 38 remedies. Not all from flowers, because there's rock water as well, which is unadulterated, pure spring water coming out of the rocks. Chestnut bud is made from the bud of the chestnut. Most of them are made from flowers that are reasonably familiar to us.
Can we have a couple of examples of what we might have found in the first 12?
To be honest, I can't say I'm sure about this, but I would probably, I'd guess that agrimony would be one of them. Agrimony being the one for presenting a very cheerful face to the world, but whilst experiencing tortured inner thoughts that you keep to yourself very successfully.
I think that's a very good example of the kind of nature of the flower essences. Could you just repeat that for the agrimony so that we get the idea of the balance of what it is the flowers are doing?
Yeah, I think I used to be an agrimony child, so I'm quite familiar with this one myself. I was always presenting a cheerful face to the world, whilst never admitting that there might be some other churny, not-so-comfortable things going on inside, and I'm still familiar with it as a state. So the art of the Bach flower practitioner, if you like, is to recognise that state, to look behind the cheerful face that this bubbly person is presenting to you, and maybe asking some pertinent questions to bring out of them the fact that this is only a facade, and yes, they agree that there are some other things going on underneath. And then by taking agrimony, they'll help to, perhaps not need to present quite such a cheerful face to the world whilst having dealt with the other stuff that was going on underneath that needed disguising so thoroughly.
So by taking, if you like, the essence of the flower that kind of is close in energy to the mental state of the individual that's being given the remedy, you get a resolution of the problem and the challenge and a moving on.
That's
a bit like homeopathy works like that as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Mechthild Schaefer, who wrote one of my favourite books about this topic, Bach Flower Therapy, Batch Flower Therapy, Theory and Practice, she puts it beautifully in her book where she says, work with the Bach Flower Remedies can release the negative energy blockage and change it to a state of positive, harmonious flow, achieving transformation and realisation. I think that's very beautifully put, because it's not talking about any personal responsibility for this blockage. It's talking about releasing the negative energy blockage through working with the, you could call it the higher self of the person who's needing the remedy, and the higher self of the person who's reading the need for which remedy.
Well, I've certainly experienced changes like exactly as described there, coincident with taking Bach Flower Remedies. It was one of the first complementary therapies that I tried, and it had quite a profound effect on me. I've noticed it have a profound effect on other people as well. You know, it might of course be a coincidence that they're just ready to take something to make the change, but it's helpful, isn't it, if the person is very receptive to the ideas and understands a little bit about the remedies themselves.
It does really help if people just take on the very simple key elements for each remedy. It helps if they have an understanding at least of that, because then they're taking an active part in their own healing process, as opposed to just being given some remedies to take without any understanding. They can work on that level, and they will work without any knowledge of the participants. I think that probably happens most frequently with rescue remedy, because a lot of people are familiar with rescue remedy. A lot of people carry it around in their bags.
It's quite mainstream now, isn't it? It's in Boots and in fact, a lot of the, what they're called, these pharmaceutical shops, I can't remember, pharmacies, a lot of pharmacies seem to be carrying rescue remedy now. Yeah.
And quite a lot of them stock the other remedies as well, you know. And you don't have to buy the whole set if you just manage to ascertain, maybe with the help of somebody who's more familiar with them, which remedies you might start with. You can always get yourself a few bottles to familiarise yourself with their use and maybe help in the process.
Yeah. So, How did you get involved with them to start with? What was your first kind of encounter with them?
Well, there was this lovely man about 30 years ago now, a lovely man, Welsh man called Gwynant. And I'd never met him before. And I was on the verge of leaving to go to Nepal for 2 years. And he introduced me to the I Ching, the colour therapy, and the Bach flower remedies in one day. Mm. And I did take the I Ching with me to Nepal. And I also I bought a whole collection, a complete set, to take with me, plus batches, books, Heal Thyself, and the 12 Healers and Other Remedies.
So that's a pretty good way of introducing yourself, isn't it? Because you had his two books, one of which is the 12 Healers and Other Remedies, in which he writes about the remedies themselves.
Yep.
Heal Thyself is more of the thought behind it, isn't it? And some of the descriptions of lifestyles that lead to the states that the plants are trying to address.
Yeah.
And they're two tiny little books, aren't they? Ever so thin.
Yep.
Like you say, published in the 1930s. So you had a full set of Bach Flower and Batch Flower Remedies and his two little books.
Yep.
And, of course, you were going to find yourself in some quite exciting states of mind, weren't you? So you'd be able to presumably try several of them on yourself.
It was ideal, in a way. I could say I went through quite a lot of extreme states of one kind or another whilst I was away. And they helped me enormously. And really, anybody who's setting out on the path of getting to know the remedies for whatever reason, whether it's for using for yourself and your friends, or whether you want to take it further afield, the best thing you can do, and what you really have to do, is to familiarise yourself in quite a detailed fashion and practice on yourself to familiarise yourself with every remedy. You won't need them all, but in the process of taking the ones that you do need, you'll come across and read about the other ones, and you'll meet people and you'll think, oh, I'd love to give them some beech, you know, or willow, or whatever springs to mind.
Yeah.
And that's how you can familiarise yourself with the whole spectrum of them.
So I presume that you know, what with having to learn the language and all that kind of stuff over in Nepal, you started off by using them mainly on yourself. Did you find them effective? Can you remember anything notable about when you first started using them? Because you were a long way from home and you weren't coming back for a couple of years.
All I can say is that I dread to think what I might have been like if I hadn't had the remedies with me to help. Yeah. Because there were depressive phases and difficult phases. Not being able to communicate was quite a difficult phase to go through. So, yeah, I helped myself enormously with the bark flower remedies, yeah.
And did you start using them with any of the locals? Because they were quite interested in Western medicine, weren't they?
They were, unfortunately. Bit too interested, perhaps, but it was, you know, as it was at that time, it was the thing to be, the modern thing to be going for. So it was really nice for me to be able to offer people something that was based on flowers, something natural, naturally occurring.
Did they have local equivalents of this? Did they have herbalists and stuff accessible to them?
It really, when I was there, it was something that was pretty much hidden. I'm pretty sure it was still there, but it really wasn't evident to the...
So was it a bizarre idea to them?
No, surprisingly enough, not. It wasn't really a bizarre idea to them. I think a lot of them would have preferred it if I'd had some antibiotics up my sleeve, because they had been convinced of their, you know, effectiveness. But no, all I had really to offer was the bark flower remedies, which I did.
Yeah.
And, some people felt that they'd helped them enormously, so... And sometimes I used them in general sense, where I would put... We came across an accident one day, so I got a bottle of water, put some rescue remedy in the water and just passed it round everybody who had just been in the accident.
Yeah.
Because it was more or less the only thing I could do in that circumstance.
Yeah, it's amazing how often the rescue remedy does pop out from somewhere now. And apparently very helpful it is. Because I think that now it's possible to measure people's reactions to these sort of things as well, isn't it? And the batch flower remedies are quite well attested.
Yeah.
How easy are they to make, just as a matter of interest? We had Juliet Cotter talking about the various essences that she was making. How do you set about it?
Pretty easy, really. I think it's great if you can be in a focused state of mind and have good intent with you. And all you do, really, when I made my snowdrop essence, and this is basically the same method they're using at the Bach Centre in Oxford as well, is you gather the flowers when they're in a state of maturity, and put them into preferably spring water in a glass bowl in the sun. So you have to find those right conditions, and then I sat with my snowdrop essence for some time and meditated a bit and sat there with them and focused intent, I suppose, for healing.
Yeah. So the intent's important as well as the energy of the flower.
I think so.
I suppose that kind of enhances it, does it?
Yeah, I think so. You might as well,
yeah,
you know, add it into the pot, because I think if you did it flippantly and without the proper focus, then it would be a shame to lose that potential.
This is one of the reasons why I think it's important every now and then to dip into what the quantum physical scientists are saying about the nature of the world, because they do seem to be discovering that consciousness itself actually changes the way, and possibly even determines the way, the apparently material universe manifests itself. And we do see these small effects, don't we? We know that water remembers.
Well, exactly. If we've seen the photographs to prove that if you put a flower into water, then every single drop of that water will hold an image of that flower.
Yes, they were interesting experiments, weren't they?
Yeah, very interesting. So when you know about the qualities of water and the energy and the memory of water, it is very much a part of this system of healing. It's a subtle system.
And then that kind of mix it with a bit of brandy or something to preserve it.
Your stock essence is in water, and then that is added to brandy for preservation.
Okay.
And then the drops are used from the brandy stock bottle to make up the mixture. So it's really talking about a very tiny amount. You say a homeopathic dose of the actual flower in there, but that's all that's needed.
Because water never forgets anyway.
Water never forgets.
So, and eventually you did go and you took quite an amount of training, didn't you?
I did, yes. I became a trained batch flower practitioner at the centre in Oxford, which is a lovely place to go. I spent a few weekends down there looking at the remedies in, some depth.
So they grow them all there, do they?
Most of them. We have olive, which presents a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
I have seen an olive tree grow in this country, and they probably have them in the glasshouses at Kew and things like that. But looking up the plants, I think, is a good idea, familiarising yourself with them in the countryside, so that when you come across them, you recognise that plant and maybe remind yourself of the soul qualities of that plant on the way past.
So as well as familiarising yourself with the remedies, what else did you have to do when you were at the Bach Flower Centre in training?
Well, we had to do a certain amount of case studies explaining our reasons for choosing particular remedies and why we hadn't chosen other remedies. So really we had to demonstrate the process of diagnosis for other people, how that had taken
place. And did they give you imaginary case studies, or did you do it with actual people?
No, I did it with people I knew. They get the part of the sort of examination process, if you like, was imaginary case studies that we answered in the spur of the moment. Mm-hmm. But most of the real work was done with proper real people.
Yeah. And one of the exercises I liked was the one where you had to come up with remedies for famous characters, so from nursery rhymes and fairy tales and stuff. So I think Cinderella was one of them, wasn't they?
That's right,
You could perhaps use Cinderella as an example to explain a little bit about the remedies mm-hmm. that you give to her as well, so that people get some feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cinderella's an interesting one, yeah. Basically, you would recommend Centauri for Cinderella because although she wasn't feeling like a victim in her situation, she sort of accepted it, but she became what might be called a doormat for the stepsisters and the stepmother. So she gave in to them and wasn't very strong in her own opinion. Maybe she didn't have a chance to be, but if you gave a Centauri, she'd be able to stand up for herself in that situation.
So, it's your turn to do the washing up.
That's right. Of course, it's a fairy tale, so we never got round to trying it out. If she'd been feeling like a victim and ranting and railing about her poor fate, then you might have given her willow.
Right, so one of them's for taking a boot sort of cheerily, and the other one's for taking a boot resenting it.
That's it.
Which is quite a nice little distinction, isn't it, really?
And then you might have given her stepsisters, some holly, which is to do with opening up to love and compassion. But in the negative state, which they definitely were, they were feeling envious and distrustful and hatred and towards their beautiful, compliant young stepsister. And you might have given the stepmother chicory for her domineering motherliness. You might have given her some of that to she wouldn't have been the stepmother she was, of course, if you'd given it to her, but it might have helped her to...
Well, quite often the characters in fairy tales and stuff do represent archetypal states, don't they?
They do.
I guess that if what he was seeking originally was sort of 12 remedies rather than 38 he ended up with, he was trying to presumably find exactly the kind of core state that is being expressed.
That's right,
By such characters. And I guess it must be quite interesting that way you get to, as you're familiarising yourself with the remedies, you get to play with imaginary characters and think, well, what would I give to them?
Well, you get to the point where when you're reading a book, whether it's fiction or not, and you'll find yourself wanting to give remedies to the characters in the book. Oh, I'd love to give him some.
Because they nearly all do have these special characteristics, don't they? This kind of driving force of whatever sort.
Yeah.
So what about Hamlet?
Well, he's a classic, isn't he? Well, he is a classic. yeah, you probably have wanted to give Hamlet Scleranthus for his vacillating indecision. Mm. He was full of indecision, wasn't he?
Yeah.
To be or not to be. He really wasn't quite sure whether he wanted to exist or not, no, even at that point.
Vacillating and procrastinating was definitely one of the things that he seemed to do best.
And he was a classic at these mysterious gloom and melancholy used to drop out of Hamlet, out of the sky. That kind of gloom is for no apparent reason. So he didn't know what his gloom was about. It just descended on him.
Yeah.
And I think everybody has a bit of mustard from time to time. It's like a little black cloud has decided to come and stand over your head and make things look a bit dark for a moment. And then, whoops, it's gone, you know. So the prolonged mustard state must be really uncomfortable for people if they've constantly got a black cloud hanging over their heads. Cherry Plum, you definitely would have given him, which is about fear of letting go, fear of losing control, angry outbursts, which he definitely had, and even the fear of doing something like taking a knife, you know, even the fear of committing suicide or getting to that kind of extreme state would be Cherry Plum. And I think he was in an extreme Cherry Plum state practically throughout the whole play.
Yes indeed. So you try to there's three each in those for Cinderella and Hamlet. I guess you do try to limit the variety of these things that you're giving in one go, just to
definitely
clarify the effect as much as anything else.
I mean, I always try to go for two, possibly three as a maximum for people. Unless you were giving them Rescue Remedy as a remedy, and Rescue Remedy contains five remedies, but when it's used as a remedy, like in a dropper bottle for a mixture for somebody to use over a period of 3 to 4 weeks, you just use four drops of the Rescue Remedy, and it contains five key remedies for shock and trauma. Yeah. So that's an exception, but mostly I would only go for two.
So what's in the Rescue Remedy then?
Rescue Remedy, and it's quite common these days, it's all over the place, little bottles of Rescue Remedy. Star of Bethlehem for trauma and numbness. It's also called the soother of pains and sorrows.
And I think that's one of the things, because most often it's handed out in crisis, isn't it? And that can be physical shock or mental shock.
Any kind of shock.
Yeah, and it can also be, if you're anticipating a shock, you can take it in advance of...
You can. It's probably best taken when you are actually in the state, but it can be taken in advance. Rock Rose is another important ingredient, which is for extreme terror and panic. And it doesn't have to be in that extreme state for you to be taking the Rescue Remedy, but quite often when Rescue Remedy comes to mind, there has been a shock or a trauma, and people may be panicking, and it will certainly help with the levels of panic at an accident scene, for example. Impatiens for irritability and tension. Quite often if there's been a calamity of some kind, people get impatient with other people aren't doing what they want them to do, or so they can get irritable and there can be a lot of tension around. So Impatiens can help with that. And then there's Cherry Plum that we also gave to Hamlet for fear of losing control, whatever that might mean in the certain situation. And Clematis for the tendency to pass out and the sensation of being far away, which might precede falling unconscious. So it's about bringing people back to the present and calming things down, dealing with all those things at once, basically, which is quite a lot of things to be dealing with in one little bottle of remedy.
Yes, indeed. And what about type remedies? Because those are all, I suppose, as you come across, as things happen to people, they find themselves in a given emotional state and needing a little bit of support to work their way through it. Mm. But I was particularly intrigued by the idea that always, as we said, the people in stories will always bring to mind one of the remedies, because almost in order to be in the story, they're going to be in an interesting state. But it did strike me when I was reading about them that that we're probably all, one way or the other, affected by one of the states that could benefit from being exposed to one of these remedies on a more regular basis. So what, do you have anything to say about kind of...
Well, yeah, I think, well, apparently each of the 38 remedies can be type remedies, although I think some of them are less likely to be. So
it might just be more unusual people.
It might be an unusual thing for somebody to be, say, a white chestnut type, for example. White chestnut is all about unwanted thoughts going round and round in your head. And it, quite often it's used as a temporary remedy for somebody who can't sleep, or they wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and stuff's going round and round and round. Anybody in a white, who was a white chestnut type would probably have found a way to cover that in their everyday lives, and then it might come out at night or something like that. People, a lot of people who suffer from insomnia, not being able to sleep, might well benefit from white chestnut.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't know anything about any of the other remedies, you might benefit from white chestnut there.
To stop the churning of the thoughts.
Yeah.
I know that mine, because I stayed with mine, my type remedy for ages, which was rock water, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Rock water is for, really, it's for being hard on ourselves and having high ideals and being a bit rigid in our thinking about things. I mean, that might sound a bit negative, but it's quite often you're dealing with a negative state when you're treating with a remedy. And, of course, the potential transformation for somebody is to be a realistic idealist, not to be unrealistically ideal. So it's transforming any initial negative connotations into the absolute positive.
Trying to get you to go with the flow.
Yeah, go with the flow and not be too hard on yourself in the process. Because, rock water is an interesting type. Agrimony is one we've mentioned as a type remedy. I think there's a lot of people who try to hide what's going on inside with by putting a cheerful face on. And it's about understanding that I still have a bit of agrimony now and again. But when you come into balance, you need it less. You need your initial type remedy less and less.
Yeah.
Or less frequently. And as you become more balanced through taking the remedies.
Yeah, and then you can simply use them if something out of the ordinary happens, or if you find yourself in an unusual state of mind, which I think happens to us all as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we're always the same from day to day. Sometimes it seems like there's completely different individuals occupying my head one day to the next.
So, yeah, I mean, using them for oneself is a really good way to familiarise yourself with them and then start treating people in fairy tales and books.
And perhaps it might be a good idea, because there are some good summaries of what each one of them is, isn't there, on the internet and the like. So you could have a quick look through and see which ones... which ones remind you of you, and
that's
then perhaps
right.
Get a little bottle and try taking some.
Yeah, yeah.
Or knowing, say, that you're enduring insomnia or other regular stresses, perhaps you might like to read about them and that way, from that, determine which of the flowers is most suitable.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's usually helpful if you're starting out with an interest in the remedies is to talk to somebody who has...
Yeah.
Although you can do it. I did it myself, basically, you know, for years before I went for the training in Oxfordshire. But if you can find somebody who is more familiar with the remedies, then you can bounce ideas with them and they can help you to intuit which remedy might be the most apposite one for you at that time, and you know,
yes, because they could probably identify several that might apply.
That's it.
And it is, I mean, we know, quite apart from the mysterious properties of the various essences and things themselves, we know that talking helps a lot, doesn't it, in a lot of cases. Actually talking to another individual about what's going on can really help sharpen your own focus.
Yeah.
And I guess this is very much a vehicle for that, isn't it? In as far as what you're doing is endeavouring to describe and then address a given psychological state.
Yeah.
Just having it described, demarcated, identified so that it can be dealt with must be helpful.
I think so. I think that's a very, very big part of the process, is accepting that there is something that needs a flower remedy inside you, and then to have a dialogue with that remedy and see how it works.
And whether it works or not, I guess, depends, again, in this kind of quantum world, on what we believe.
Yeah.
You know, if we're making our own luck, and if we're very much, our consciousness is interlacing with this, whatever it is, this realm below the realm, the next realm that we can see, to sort out what happens next, then whether or not it works for us depends to quite a great extent, rather bizarrely, I always think, on whether or not we believe it's going to work.
Well, and I mean, you can. There's a remedy for that, of course.
What do you use for that then?
Well, there'd be several that you could use for that, yeah. That particular one. The one that sprang to mind as you were speaking then. Well, there is a remedy for having given up hope. And some people might come to you thinking, well, I know this isn't going to work. But, you know, I mean, if you think it might help, you know what I mean? They've practically given up hope. I think it's gorse. Whereas then taking the gorse remedy might actually help them to believe that something out there might be of use to them, and that it'll move them from their state of helplessness and despair.
Yeah.
Then there's different states, different extremities of helpless and despair. So, yeah. You know, it might actually help somebody in that state of mind to take a remedy for it.
Great, whether they believed it or not.
And then, well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating.
Yes.
If you feel that you've been helped by the remedies, you're more likely to carry on taking your mixture until the bottle's empty.
Yeah.
And then maybe going back or to see that person again and talking about maybe the next mixture you can have, because... Yeah. You won't bother unless you're feeling it's helping you.
And people do come back for more, don't they?
They do indeed. They do indeed. And once the initial introduction has been made, then that's really very much up to them.
Yeah.
Whether they come back, whether they finish their bottle, whether they bring it back for a refill, whatever.
Well, I think it's great to see the Bach Flower Remedies back out on the shelf again. It's you've been giving them a bit of a rest of late.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, it's very exciting for me actually to be getting back into them again, because I realise how useful and valuable they are, and having seen recently some real quite marked differences made in people I know by the taking of the remedies, I need to thank those people, because they've kicked me into action again.
Yes.
You know, I think, well, what have I got? What can I do? And I think, well, I've got a whole set of Bach flower remedies. I can do that. So I've actually recently started to offer them to people.
That's the other important thing, isn't it? Is that they quite clearly do work for some people, like homeopathy. And obviously homeopathy doesn't only work for people, it works for horses. You can use the flower remedies seem to work on animals as well, don't they? Which is an uncanny sort of thing, really.
Yeah. Like I said, you don't have to be conscious of the properties of a flower essence to be helped by them, because you can use them on plants, animals and babies. Although babies are conscious, I would argue they can't take a part in the choosing of the remedy. But I heard a lovely little story, it was in this book, of if you want to find the right remedy for a baby, take a few remedies that you think might be applicable in that case, and place the bottle in the cot with the baby, and the baby will probably gurgle and smile and maybe sleep easily with that remedy in the cot, whereas they might express some discomfort and cry when the wrong remedy was in the cot. So I'd really love to try that out.
Yeah, that'd be great. That's a great use for a baby.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, perhaps in whilst you're revising your Bach flower remedies and stuff, you might come across another group to describe to us at some point.
I'd love to,
Another few 10 or 15 minute sessions on them.
Yes.
Yeah. I think, if nothing else, it's useful to recognise that these states do exist in us, these states of mind, and that they can arise and that they can go away again as well.
Yeah.
And sort of recognising that as going on and choosing to engage with it is going to be more helpful than just continuing to randomly throw yourself through life.
That's it. It's taking it on board, really, a possibility, and as a beautiful system of healing.
Yeah, and they call them the the Nepali people called it soul medicine.
They did. That was their translation of my pidgin Nepali description of the remedies was soul medicine, yeah.
That seems like a fairly good description to it to me. So anybody who fancies a bit of medicine for the soul,
yeah,
it's well worth having a look. Yeah. Bar flower remedies are coming straight at you out of the subquantal world.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Sinquo.
No problem. Thank you, Doctor.
That was Not For Me from the John Preston tribute band, who you'll remember that we saw for the first time at this year's Fire in the Mountain Festival. Before that, Backman Turner Overdrive, and You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. And sure shit, if we're learning one thing, it's that we ain't seen nothing yet. Before that, I was talking with, having a bit of an introductory chat with Synchro about some of the batch flower remedies, and hopefully she'll be coming back to talk about more of them as she gets through her revision. In the meantime, thanks very much to Synchro for coming on and talking to me, and to Bear for coming and chatting about kinesiology and healing, and Tim Wheater for expanding my knowledge a little bit about sound healing and for his beautiful tunes on the recorders. Thanks, of course, to PIR, peoplesinternetradio.com, for letting me continue to be here, and to all those people who are still in the chat box at this late hour of night, gone the witching hour. So thanks to Azure and Chug and D Greer and Almont321 and Goodwill and Hugh and Jar Rocks, James O'Brien, Jay and Johnny Meath, John McHugh, Mahatma Code, Main Admin, Higher Main Admin, Nick Nomic, Sam and Super Big Bagman for being in there to the end. And one more tune to go, and if everything goes according to plan, I'll be back with you again next week. Thanks for being out there, folks. We'll play out with 2.5 minutes of Motörhead, and then I'll be gone.